she hated being right.
Well, said the gauge complacently, that'll be the thing, then, that's been making your buzzing sounds. Well, it's better than a maggot curse, right?
The gauge offered when they had withdrawn 100 yards or so and were considering their options. Crossing that crushed shell barren seemed much, much less appealing than it had previously.
Giant wasps?
The dead man shook his head emphatically.
I think not.
Hornets, said Lizzie. The dead man looked at her. The gauge might have also. It was hard to tell in a creature that did not need eyes to see and did not seem to turn his head except when he remembered to. They're called corpse wasps, Lizzie said, feeling pedantic even as she embarked upon the explanation. But taxonomically speaking, they are hornets. They form nests, colonies. The dead man leaned forward.
So we must expect a great many of these creatures?
She nodded. The gauge said,
but they're probably not interested in humans unless you threaten their nest, right? They eat fruit or something?
The adults eat fruit, she agreed. But the weight of their attention stopped her, then compelled her to continue. They do sting animals, including people, and carry them back to the nest for the larvae to feed on. That's why they're called corpse wasps. Although technically they're not feeding on corpses, at least not to start, because the prey animals are just, well, paralyzed.
Oh, there's your maggots,
the gauge said to the dead man. The dead man rocked back explosively.
You knew about these things?
I know they exist, Lizzie said defensively. I didn't know there were any here. Anyway, if you separate the infertile workers from the hives, they become really docile. She had a sense they were both staring at her, though with the gauge it was hard to tell. They make great pets.
Pets, the dead man said. People use them like watchdogs.
Oh no, they're far too tame for that.
Eastmouth's bright pen,
the dead man said, and closed his eyes above his veil. They discussed waiting until nightfall. But Lizzie pointed out that many insect species were more active at dusk and after dark, and the hornets could probably sense warmth anyway, so moving by daylight would actually afford them more protection.
Theoretically,
the gauge said. Theory is what we have, Lizzie answered. I think it's unlikely, however, that they will be able to carry you off, Brass Man. He chimed like a massive clock, his mechanical laughter.
That does not, however, solve the problem of how to get you two past them.
Mud, Lizzie said, the excitement of an idea upon her. And more Zodia. The pillars of the palace look too close together for the wasps to fly or crawl through, so I think if we reach it, we should be mostly safe inside. But to get us there...
Mud, the dead man said.
Lizzie nodded. And lots of it. The first half of their approach across the barren to the palace went, Lizzie thought, surprisingly well. The green, heady scent of the Zodia surrounded them densely, almost palpable on the air, making her lightheaded. Their skin was invisible under a layer of pounded plant pulp and mud. The only problem was that the mud leaf compound, which had stayed pliable in the moist shade under the leaves, began to dry and whiten almost immediately as they came out into the punishing sun. She thought they would be all right if they hurried, but the mud cracked and flaked off, and they had not thought to plaster the gauge. It might not be possible for the corpse wasps to sting him or carry him off, but it seemed as if the sunlight dazzling from his brazen hide nevertheless attracted the giant insects. They had been walking, crouched down under camouflage improvised from handfuls of palm fronds she'd cut with her long knife, the saw-toothed stem edges wrapped in torn cloth to protect their hands. The heavy thrumming heralded a shadow passing over, first one, then another, and another, until the crushed shells underfoot were darkened with blurry blotches. The corpse wasp swirled down toward the gauge, who uttered what Lizzie assumed was an ungentlemanly word in his own tongue, and drew his ragged homespun robes and hood close about his featureless form. Lizzie ducked.
I should have thought of that.
So should I,
the gauge answered. A wasp as long as he was tall veered down, rumbling like a charging elephant, and clanged against his upstretched arm. Lizzie stared for a moment. She thought of drawing her knife, then thought how laughable a blade merely as long as her forearm would be against something like that. Then, as a second shadow swelled around her, she found her feet and glanced over at the dead man, who beckoned with an outstretched hand, too polite to grab her elbow and drag her with him. His eyes were white-rimmed, and as she started toward him, bent almost double, he turned and fled beside her. She was getting the impression that he held no real love for bugs. Another clang and a heavy, squashing thud followed them. Lizzie stumbled while trying to look back, and this time the dead man did touch her shoulder.
He'll be fine.
She had to trust him. Side by side, they ran toward the completely theoretical safety of the palace. They were doing all right until they tripped over the corpse. It was just inside the pillars, where the shadow of the roof made it nearly impossible to see through the glare of the sun without. In retrospect, Lizzie realized that she'd smelled it before she found it, but between the stench of the tomb, that of the festering mud, and the reek of the Zodia, her memory hadn't automatically supplied the information that this particular terrible odor belonged to some sort of large and very dead thing. The body had probably been that of a man, but it was bloated with stings now, the skin stretched and crackling with the products of decomposition. Lizzie was startled to see that no maggots writhed through its flesh. Surely the smell should have attracted every blowfly on the island by now. Lizzie hadn't fallen, but she'd sprawled against a pillar in the second rank, and her palm fronds had gone everywhere. She turned back, the breath knocked out of her, looking for the dead man. She wheezed in horror, her spasming lungs unable to shriek a warning, as the corpse lurched and twitched and began to push itself upright behind him. Fortunately, Lizzie's wits, even scattered, were sufficient. With her right hand, she fumbled for her blade and shook it free of the sheath, which fell at her feet. She'd worry about that if she lived. Her bruised and scraped left hand, she raised, waving it frantically to get the dead man's attention and pointing past his shoulder. He had good reflexes and must have decided she was worthy of at least some trust. He ducked even as he turned, and the corpse's clumsy, club-handed swipe whistled over his head and thudded against the pillar with a noisome splatter.
"He isn't dead,"
the dead man yelped. "Oh, he's dead all right," Lizzie answered. "And mercifully, too." She could see what the dead man could not. The corpse's spine had been eaten away, and beneath the shredding skin pulsated the translucent segments of a great larva. She hoped he was dead anyway, hoped with all the force of her rising gorge, even though thick blood welling slowly from some of the fresh tears in the necrotic flesh seemed to give the lie to her desire. Even as Lizzie recoiled, the innate curiosity that had led her to natural philosophy made her focus her attention on the grub. It had a glossy black head like polished obsidian, and Lizzie could see the pincery mouth parts embedded in the base of the dead man's skull. The visible part of each was long as her finger, and the gentleness of the taper suggested that they continued for some distance more within the base of the brain. Segmented legs were visible here and there, grasping deep within the festering body. The larva contracted along its length, a sick, rippling pulse. The corpse convulsed, whirling toward Lizzie now in its staggering, seizing dance. The foul arms windmilled, and she glimpsed, with ever-increasing horror, that the eyes within the slipping skin were clear, not clouded and dead. "Storm dragons cleanse it with thunder," she thought, and lunged out of the way. She swung with the knife, but the floor under a layer of plant detritus was mosaic, and what had once been smooth was now heaved by roots. Chunks of stone littered it from the collapsing roof. They snagged her feet and slammed her toes so sharp, pain shot up her legs. She wasn't sure how she kept her feet. Then she wasn't sure how she had lost them. She twisted, falling, and landed on her ass, looking up at the deliquescing face of the horror that pursued her. The thing staggered like a drunk, dragging one leg and stomping wildly with the other, swaying and wavering. She stuck her long knife out like a ward. Over the blade, she saw the dead man raise his right hand. Something glinted bright against the blue of his veil, followed by a stone-cracking retort and the cleansing reek of black powder. The parasite jerked with the impact and collapsed unceremoniously across Lizzie's lower legs, twitching faintly. Lizzie screamed through clenched teeth, in disgust as much as pain, and yanked her ankles clear. She huddled, panting, while the dead man swiftly reloaded his gun. A shadow fell over her, and she looked up, pulse accelerating. It was the Gauge, his robe and brass carapace streaked with fluids of two or three colors. Ichor, she judged, and probably venom. He was wiping his big metal gauntlet hands on the robe, leaving unidentifiable streaks. Then he bent and picked up her soft leather scabbard from where it had fallen among the litter.
"Well," he said, offering a cleaner gauntlet to Lizzie, "that seems to have got their attention. Get up. There's a flight headed this way, and they might be able to squeeze through the pillars." "Or," said the dead man, without holstering his pistol, "there might be more of those."
He gestured at the thing on the ground, which still quivered faintly.
"There were four sets of footprints."
Lizzie pulled herself up with the Gauge's help, bruises stiffening. She stowed her knife. Then she bent down and with both hands hefted a sizable chunk of rubble, one that made her grunt to lift. She thought of the brown, clear eyes in the parasitized thing's melting face. She lifted the rock to chest height and threw it toward the ground. It struck the host's skull with a terrible sound, and the quivering stopped. "Now we can go." The droning buzz of the corpse wasps grew heavier, more layered, until Lizzie felt the vibrations in the hollowness that had been her chest. She imagined she could watch the tremors shimmer across the Gauge's surface. If she looked back, she could see that the light was dimming, not simply because they picked their way deeper into the palace complex, but also because the bodies of enormous wasps, layered one over another, blocked the white glare of the sun. The insects had a smell, in such quantities, musty, like dry leaves, but not so clean. None of the travelers asked how they would be able to leave the palace now that they had won entrance to it, but Lizzie was thinking about it. Maybe they could wait until it rained. A soaking thunderstorm was never far in the Banner Islands, where the dragons roamed the sea of storms. Flying insects took shelter in rough weather, lest they be blown out to sea. She hoped that applied to insects 8 feet long. There was light ahead, and they made for it. The dead man's teeth chattered behind his veil, but his gun hand was steady. He held a scimitar drawn in his offhand, and that seemed steady too. The Gauge moved with surprising delicacy between the columns, though his carelessness could probably have knocked the whole moldering palace down. They came to an open space, unroofed, where the drone of the swarm was pronounced but distant, rising and falling like the mechanical noise of cicadas. Litter-filled ornate fountains and statuary bore witness that this had been a formal courtyard. A gigantic tree rumpled the surrounding paving stones and clutched benches it must once have shaded in gnarled roots, as if at any moment it might heave itself free of the earth and come forward, swinging them as weapons. Beyond, a tall building was surrounded by the litter of its own crumbling verandas. Like the pillars, it was shaded from black through white to red. It had once had glass windows, a profound luxury for the era and the place when it was built, and a few unbroken panes still gleamed.
"Can we cross that?"
the Gauge asked, stopping within the shelter of the penultimate rank of pillars.
"We must,"
the dead man answered, with a glance at Lizzie. She was the employer, she remembered. She could call this off right now. But her life was service, and besides, they could not go back. "We must," Lizzie agreed, and was looking about her for a plan, or at least a cluster of zodia plants, when the painted door up the steps behind the wreckage of the veranda opened, and a woman, dressed in a white skirt and twining sandals, her long hair braided back as thick as Lizzie's wrist, stood framed against interior darkness. Lizzie touched the hilt of her long knife.
"Well, don't just stand there," the woman said. "It's safe to cross the open space right now, as long as you move quickly. I spent a long time studying the corpse wasps. I know a great deal about parasites."
The darkness inside the doorway, once they had scrambled over the rubble of the wrecked courtyard and climbed gingerly up the steps, which settled under the gauge's weight but did not crack, was less absolute than Lizzie had anticipated. It was only the contrast with the glare of the direct sun that had made it seem pitch black behind the woman. In reality, the interior of the palace was comfortably dim and cool. And the interior of the palace was in much better repair than the courtyard or the pillared colonnade. Ropes of necklaces and heavy bangles shifted and shone as she closed the door behind them, the gold rich against her brown skin. She was tanned, Lizzie could see the paler brown behind the waistband of her skirt, but there were no tan lines behind the jewelry. There were wooden amulets sewn into the wrap cloth, though, and those looked long established, with frayed threads and bits of mud in the fine lines of the designs.
"The Emperor is waiting for you. I am the Lady Potashny, his voice."
She spoke with awkward dignity, worn like those unaccustomed jewels, and gestured them to follow her. The woman's feet and ankles were dirty under the sandals, as if she had walked through soupy mud, then shod herself without being able to first clean her feet. Lizzie saw the dead man gazing at them speculatively over his veil, and she knew he was comparing their size to the footprints beside the canoe. She was about to ask how a voice came to be so presently arrived in a deserted kingdom, but words interrupted her. Someone spoke. Her name. She glanced around. There was no one present except the gauge, the dead man, and this Potashny. They were in an entrance hall of crumbling grandeur, hung with silk brocade so brittle it was shredding under its own weight, and stacked with furniture coated in layers of dust. The walls were pale coral in shades of pink and white. They had once been hung with tapestries, but the tapestries had broken their threads and fallen from their rings. No one could be hiding behind them. And the voice that said her name again was like a rustle of wasp wings in her mind.
"Dr. Lady Lizzie, have you too come to disturb my rest, granddaughter?"
She blinked with shock, and though the floors here were smooth, she stumbled, so the gauge had to steady her elbow. She saw the Lady Potashny glance over her shoulder speculatively and frown. Lizzie kept her face carefully blank. Experimentally, she thought, King Fire Mountain Dynasty?
"You serve the new king."
"How is it that you are speaking to me, Your Majesty? I am not your descendant."
"Are you sure?"
She could sense his amusement.
"Descent through a mother's line is often forgotten, and what person can say for certain who is his father? You have enough of my blood in you for the palace to awaken to your steps."
Lizzie considered that for a moment. She allowed herself to drift to the end of the group trailing Lady Potashny, where Lizzie could just follow the shoulders in front of her and not concern herself too much with what her features showed. Who was the man with the wasp inside him?
Lady Potashny's companion, one of them. There are two others. I think one was her husband.
Do you control the wasps? Did you do that to him?
The wasps are my guardians, but I do not control them. Long ago, I did bind their ancestors to this place. He and the others trespassed, and the wasps defended me.
He sounded matter-of-fact. If he was Lady Potashny's companion, how did he come to trespass?
She was yet Potashni, the old king said, but not yet lady when it happened. She brought the men with her as a sacrifice, and she has some little talismans that give her certain powers. Will you be my voice, granddaughter?
So the Lady Potashni was, as the canoe had suggested, a recent addition to the royal household. How had she come to pass unscathed through the corpse wasps, Lizzie wondered, apparently alone of her party of four, and why did she seem so calm, despite the deaths? I spent a long time studying the corpse wasps. I know a great deal about parasites. Lizzie said, or thought, hard and clearly, you have a voice.
So I do, the dead king answered. One voice, after a fashion. Is it not better to have a choice than to have no choices?
But you have a voice already.
And you have one too. Do you speak out with it in your own words, or do you silence it, except when commanded to its use by another?
It was the same question he had asked before, which she had dodged, but more provocatively phrased this time. Was the dead king needling her, trying to get her to rise to the bait? What if I don't have anything to say? The undead king did not answer. She wondered if she needed to intend to speak to him for him to hear, or if he were politely ignoring her own interior monologue. I serve King Pale Empire, she said, but he does not own my voice.
That is good to hear, granddaughter. Ah, you are nearly to the presence chamber. Do not allow Lady Potashni to know that you can speak to me, Dr. Lady Lizzie. Not yet. It would be unwise.
Well, that painted Lizzie with a wash of unease. Ahead, Lady Potashni had stopped before an iron-bound door. It seemed recently maintained, and there were fresh scratches around the keyhole, which was sized to admit an enormous old-fashioned key. Potashni lifted just such a key from inside her skirt pocket. A ribbon connected it to the material of her garment. It had been sewn into place with hasty stitches and thread that did not match. She turned the key, struggled with the weight of the door before prevailing, and led them into another space, shadowy and echoing from its depths. Nuggets of glass turned under Lizzie's feet. She was distracted, keeping her balance, and watching the gauge pick his way carefully until she realized that if the glass did not crush into powder under his feet, then it was not glass at all, but gemstones. Rubies and sapphires in every color of the rainbow littered the floor. A priceless trip hazard. Lizzie thought with frustration of kingdoms where such riches would not be left uselessly to molder as symbols of the bygone might of dead emperors, but used to support trade, to buy medicines, to feed the poor. How much had her island home suffered through the centuries because of waste such as this? This, all this treasure. How much linen could it buy from the mainland for sails? How much hemp for ropes? The Sea of Storms protected the Banner Islands from any raiders more significant than the occasional pirate, but the Banner Islands, though rich in foodstuffs and spices and hardwood, were otherwise natural resource poor. Trade was their lifeline. This would pay for trade. As they reached the center point of the hall, lights flared in sconces along both sides. They looked like torch flames, but burned strikingly violet and blue, and there were no torches beneath them. Their light stained the gauge's bronze hide a most unearthly color and sent thick, watery, reflected bands of radiance rippling across everything in the hall. More wealth gleamed on every side, and before them, another 50 steps or so along the enormous hall, was a throne whose golden seat hung suspended between two mammoth ivory tusks that crossed at the top in barbaric splendor. The throne stood empty. The dead man's step checked. Lady Potashni, though, seemed to have anticipated it. Without turning her head, she said, "His Majesty is in the presence chamber." She turned them to the right and brought them to a small door, much more human in scale than the one she had struggled with, recessed between two pillars in the side wall. This one was unlocked, apparently, for she simply manipulated the handle and opened it. It revealed a small, comfortably furnished room that was lit with the same eerie blue flames, but did not need them. At the far end, two multi-paned windows, big as doors, framed a song-style ox-yoke armchair of carved wood and cracking leather, fragile with age, but still strong enough to support the slight weight of the corpse who slouched in it. He was little more than a collection of brown sticks wrapped in moldering silken brocades, decorated with ropes of jewels. Over the robes, the corpse wore a dust-coated cloak. There were places where the heavy, feathery dust had been disturbed, brushed, or blown off, and beneath them, Lizzie glimpsed the iridescent, translucent wings of insects, sewn together in tiers like the feathers of a bird. The corpse was mummified, the skin glossy brown as lacquered leather. White bits of bone showed through where the fingers had crumpled or been gnawed by rats. Following Potashny, Lizzie and the others approached. The gauge's footsteps made a heavy, careful sound on the flagstones. The dead king smelled of moths and attics, dry, fluttery things.
"I never could stand that throne room,"
said King Fire Mountain Dynasty, and Lizzie swallowed and tried not to think too much about the fact that she was in a close little room with his thousand-year-old body.
"Drafty, old pile. This is a much better place to wait for eternity."
Lizzie bowed low before the chair. After a confused glance, the gauge and the dead man did as well.
"King Fire Mountain Dynasty bids you welcome and rise."
Lizzie hadn't heard him say any such thing, but perhaps he just hadn't spoken to her. Lizzie turned to the lady voice and said, "Your friend is dead." Potashny frowned at her in mild distaste.
"My husband?"
She shrugged. How had Potashny known which of her companions they had encountered? The gauge made his chiming chuckle, and Lizzie thought of King Fire Mountain Dynasty's warning about talismans. Potashny twisted a hand in the folds of her white skirt.
"His Majesty commands your assistance. He wishes to be carried from this place and to the beach."
Lizzie held her breath for a moment, gathering her courage. "What are the floats for?"
"Floats?
The fishing buoys, in your canoe."
"Oh," Potashny said, "for floating King Fire Mountain Dynasty back to the Big Island, of course."
"Back to the Big Island?"
"Of course," she repeated. "You don't think he wants me to stay here forever, do you? With his treasure and my status as his granddaughter?"
Potashny smiled.
"We will have a good life. Of course, if you help me, I will share some of my wealth with you. Now, please, have your soldier and your—"
She waved a hand vaguely at the gauge.
"Lift him and carry him down to the lagoon."
"That is not what I require of you, granddaughter."
And in a flash of comprehension, as if he had shown her a map, Lizzie understood what the dead king did require of her. It came on a tremendous warmth, a sense of belonging, of being part of something. She rebelled against his request.
"I have only found you."
"And would you, too, use me for power and wealth?"
She felt deep shame. "Wealth is why I came here, but not for me, for the current king."
"And will he not reward you?"
"He has,"
she stopped, thought, "given me service, given me a place."
"Well," the old king answered, "if that is all you want, granddaughter."
"I want you," she answered. "I have only just found you. Do not make me give you up so soon."
"I am tired, and you see what I've had to contend with in certain branches of the family."
He didn't move, of course. He couldn't. He hadn't moved in 1,000 years. But she still had a sense of a dismissive flick of his fingers in the direction of the Lady Potashny.
"Pick him up!"
Potashny demanded, increasingly shrill.
"Is that what you require us to do?"
the dead man asked.
"It is you who holds our contracts, Doctor Lady."
"You are my only family."
She stopped herself from saying it, thinking it out loud. Whatever she was or was not, she would not guilt trip a man who had been alone for 600 years because she was lonely.
Well, no, actually, Lizzie said. She closed her eyes. She liked this long, undead ancestor whom she had so swiftly become acquainted with. She felt a great, tearing sense of loss as she took a deep breath and said, I want you to destroy him.
If she expected an outraged outburst, she didn't get it. The dead man just said, curiously,
So there is in truth no curse?
Of course there's a curse, she scoffed. Do you think any of this stuff would still be in there if there wasn't a curse? But he wanted to be left alone, not protected. And now he has been alone a very long time, and what he wants is to be gone.
How can you know that? Potashny said. You can't talk to him. I am his voice.
She's got the contracts, the gauge said tiredly. Or rather, her king does. Please stand aside, Lady Potashny.
The brass man took a step forward. The lady in the white skirt did not step aside. She wheeled and fell to her knees, clutching the mummified legs of the ancient king. They flaked and crumbled at her touch.
Let me serve you, ancestor, Potashny cried.
Lizzie felt her mouth shape words, her throat stretch to allow a voice of foreign timbre to pass.
The only service I require is destruction, child, she said aloud. What service you offer is for yourself and not for the kingdom.
Potashny's sobs dried as if her throat had closed on them. She rose gracefully, the cultivated daintiness of a lady. Lizzie wondered where she had come from and what had brought her here. It itched in her conscience and her curiosity that she would probably never know. Potashny turned to face the gauge. He towered over her, and she seemed frail and small. Her hands twisted in the waistband of her skirt, clutching at the amulet sewn there. Her mouth pressed together until no red was left, and Lizzie thought if there hadn't been flesh and teeth in the margin, bone would have rasped on bone. It was the expression of an unwanted child who is reminded that there are children for whom parents make sacrifices. Lizzie felt it in her bones and knew the interior shape of it intimately. There are children for whom parents make sacrifices. It's a thing some take a long while to understand in their hearts, even if they see it with their eyes. Experience is a more potent teacher than observation, and Lizzie had never had a sacrifice made for her sake either. A terrible pity took her. Potashny looked Lizzie in the eyes, forward as a lover, and spoke to her as if to King Fire Mountain Dynasty.
Let me serve you, grandfather. You are my family. I need you. You are my ancestor, grandfather. I honor you. I have honored you and all my ancestors all my life, with my sorcery and with my search. You owe me this small thing.
Lizzie's lips moved around that voice that came not from her lungs, but somewhere else.
I am tired, granddaughter. Take half my jewels. Make a life with that.
Why do you speak through me? Lizzie asked. Why not her?
She has protections in place for that as well. I can speak to her, but not through her, and these words need to be spoken aloud.
I do not want your jewels, grandfather.
Potashny straightened up, her muddy feet in their laced sandals set stubbornly on carpet that was more moth-hole than knot and warp.
I want to be your voice.
The hard line of her mouth softened. She looked up at the gauge, who had stopped just out of his own ability to reach her, like a man trying not to frighten a cornered kitten. She said to the giant metal man,
I've come all this way for him, and it's not fair. Women are only allowed to hold power through men. Why won't he help me?
It was a child's voice. It cut Lizzie like a knife. The ridges of wound, gummed cloth on the hilt of her machete were rough against her palm. And then Potashny steeled herself and said,
Then I shall help myself.
She twisted her hands in her skirts. She shouted, a shrill and wavering scream. One of the amulets at her waistband swelled with a green glow like light through young leaves. It streamed between her fingers in rays like the sun parting clouds. The gauge took a step forward, ornate tiles powdering under his foot. The dead man reached for his gun. They were both too late. The side light windows flanking the dead king's chair of estate shattered in a hail of glass and buzzing. Two infected, flailing men stumbled into the room, followed by a half dozen corpse wasps. The men both waved machetes haphazardly. The wasps brandished dagger-like stingers damp at the tip with droplets of paralytic poison. Lizzie, with her hand on her sheathed knife, froze. She made one startled sound, a yelp of surprise rather than a moan of terror, and then her body locked in place as surely as if the wasps had already had their way with her. She watched her reflection grow in a gargantuan, glossy, green-black thorax. The part of the brain that screams, "Run, run," in those dreams where your body seems immured in glass, was informing her calmly that this was the last instant of her life. The dead man stepped in front of her and shot the corpse wasp between the eyes. Dust shifted from between the stones overhead. The shot wasp tumbled to the floor and buzzed, legs juddering, the spasms of its wings trembling the stones under Lizzie's feet. The sound of the gun was enormous. It filled Lizzie's ears and head and left room for nothing else. No other sound, no thought, and not even the paralyzing fear. She fumbled her machete into her hand. She hacked at the nearest threatening thing, the convulsing wasp's stinger. She severed it in two sharp whacks and looked up to see the dead man still standing before her, parrying wild swings by one of the parasitized men. The gauge was fending off two wasps, their stingers leaving venom-smeared dents in his carapace. Potashny, her hair escaping its thick braid, had fallen back to stand before the chair of estate of the corpse she would have be her king. She had her own long knife drawn from its sling at the small of her back, but was holding it low and tentatively, as if she did not know how she would fight with it. And between Lizzie and Potashny were five angry hornets and two pathetically disgusting, not quite corpses. So that wasn't really a solution. A wasp came in from the left, furiously intent on the dead man, as he drove Potashny's parasitized companion back, step by step. Its wings and the back of its thorax struck the ceiling as it curved, bringing its stinger to bear. Lizzie stepped forward and brought the machete down hard and sharp, as if she were trying to cut a poison sap vine with one blow. It struck the underside of the heavy, chitinous abdomen and stuck there with a sound like an axe buried in wood. Splinters of the insect's carapace and splatters of pulpy interior flew, and the machete stuck fast. With an angry buzz and a clatter of its mandibles, the sapphire-eyed insect tried to turn on her. Its feet scratched at her face and hair. She ducked to shield her eyes and held frantically to the long knife's handle, locking her elbow and pushing the pulsing, seeking stinger away. The dead man was too busy with his maggot man and another of the wasps to come to her aid. Lizzie screamed with all her might and twisted the blade sharply. The wasp's carapace shattered with a crack, and the stinger twisted and went slack. The thing made a horrible buzz and tried to bite. She hammered at the jeweled eye with the pommel of the long knife, as it was too close to use the blade. Now she screamed, or at least yelled vigorously. There was a revolting crunch, and the enormous wasp, which was terribly light, she realized, for its size, as if it were mostly hollow inside, scrabbled at her once more and fell away. She looked up into the featureless face of the gauge, smeared with ichor and more nameless things. "The wasps are protecting the larvae," Lizzie said, as sure of the truth behind the inspiration as if she had learned it at her father's knee. "Potashny doesn't control the adults, just the larvae and the corpses."
"Destroy the king."
The gauge's head did not turn as his left hand flashed out to snatch at the wing of another wasp as it darted toward the dead man. He used its own momentum to slam it into the ceiling, his metal body pivoting inhumanly like a turret at the waist. He continued in a level tone, or maybe it was just that all its nuances were flattened by her deafness.
If Potashny has nothing to fight for, she'll stop.
Dragon's breath, I hope so.
Lizzie thought she might be desperate enough to keep fighting anyway, having nothing else to live for.
Get me through.
The gauge did not respond in words. Instead, it turned again, seamlessly, and lurched forward, flailing with its enormous arms. It didn't attempt to prevent the enemies from striking it, and it didn't seem to care if it struck them. It just created a flurry of motion that surrounded Lizzie and fended the enemies away. It walked sideways, crab-wise, toward the dead king and his voice. He turned, still keeping her in the shelter of his parries, and Lizzie was next to the place where King Fire Mountain Dynasty slumped in his finery. She could smell him, not rot, but salt and natron and harsh acetone. Potashny seemed to realize what they were about and whirled on them.
No!
She shouted. She would have rushed at Lizzie, but the gauge caught her effortlessly around the waist and held her tight. She hammered at him with the pommel of her long knife, and the room might have rung like a bell if Lizzie's ears had not still felt stuffed with wool. Holding on to Potashny limited the gauge's effectiveness in fending the wasps away from Lizzie, but the dead man was between her and the enemy, a whirl of blades and faded crimson coat skirts. It was hard, so hard, to turn her back on the fight, on the slashing stingers and whirling blades, the clang of machete on scimitar, the screaming and flailing of the would-be voice. But she did, ran two steps through the chaos, hefting her long knife, and stopped by the chair of the king.
That will not do the job, granddaughter. For this, you need fire.
Fire,
she said aloud. She didn't look, but somehow there was a powder horn in her hand, and a flint and steel. The dead man's powder horn. Fire. Black powder would burn nearly anything. She poured it over the dead king, his rotting robes, his ropes of gold and jewels, his crooked, slipping crown, his face drawn tight to the skull, the nose a caved-in hole, his eye sockets empty with the withered lids sagging into them. She poured the contents of the horn over him, into his lap, into the tired wisps of his staring hair. She dropped the horn. She clutched the flint and iron and raised them over the corpse of the king. Behind her, all the sounds of battle ceased. The buzzing continued, but when Lizzie risked a glance, she saw that the one remaining parasite host had staggered back and was leaning against the wall by the door, and the two adult wasps that were still alive and mobile crouched in front of him, one on the ceiling and one on the floor, protecting the young of the hive, but not themselves immediately attacking.
Please,
Potashny said. She had stopped struggling as well, and now just hung in the gauge's grasp, bedraggled and bruised, her long knife on the floor where it had fallen from her hand.
All this for a family, Potashny said tiredly.
My family is gone,
King Fire Mountain Dynasty said through Lizzie.
And you gave yours to the wasps in exchange for a weapon, grandchild.
The dead man looked at him, head sideways, at the mummy, Lizzie noticed, and not at the voice. Used to marvels, this mercenary.
You have family in this room. I would have given you my life.
Keep it for yourself,
he counseled.
End this.
Lizzie struck a spark. She had been too cautious and kept her hand too far away. It fell and fizzled. Potashny screamed. Lizzie struck again. This time it flared, and the powder caught. She backed hastily away from a shower of sparks and the strange dry smoke of burning mummy. King Fire Mountain Dynasty burned like a torch once he caught, and said nothing further in Lizzie's head, not even the whisper of a thank you. Well, it was what she should have expected of a king.
You ruined me,
Potashny said dully.
You have ruined everything.
Lizzie glanced at the wasps, which seemed to have no intention of charging these dangerous creatures again. They buzzed menace and held the door. Lizzie and her mercenaries were going to have to climb out a window.
He gave you jewels, she said to Potashny. Take whatever you can carry. May you find joy in it.
Lizzie sat alone on the beach beside a tree, waiting for the sun to rise and the auspicious voyage to return. She fretted the edge of her machete with her thumbnail. It was, understandably, dull. She looked up as two silhouettes approached.
Did you get him?
The gauge shook his head, which gleamed softly in the moonlight. He sat down on her left, the dead man on her right.
We looked. The wasps must have taken their last offspring somewhere safe from the likes of us.
Poor man, Lizzie said.
After a while, the silence of lapping waves was broken by the dead man's voice.
So, he said, we shall collect our pay soon and be traveling on. And then, where do you go from here, Doctor Lady?
It's not hard to live here, she said. She gestured to the jungle behind them, the sea before, beyond. Many people are content with the breadfruit, the harvest of the lagoons, the coconuts and mangoes, and the pounded hearts of palm. Many people are content to sail and swim and find somebody to fight and make babies with.
But it was never enough for you.
Lizzie heard the length of her own pause and the snort that followed.
Maybe the restlessness runs in the blood like the sea. My parents sailed off in search of an uncharted island and never returned, did you know that? Into the dragon-infested sea of storms. They took my brother with them. I was judged too young. They had ambition, and it killed them. I had ambition, and also I was afraid.
So you studied the arts of science?
I learned to read, she said. I learned to heal. I learned to kill by poison and by blade, because you cannot learn to create without learning to destroy. And the reverse, of course, holds true as well. I made a place for myself in the service of King Pale Empire, my life at his command.
The dead man nodded, perhaps sympathetically. He leaned against the tree she sat beside.
But it wasn't enough. I felt like I was scraping mud from the bottom of the well, that it was filling with salt water from beneath.
You can only give so much from a well until you fill it again, with rain or with buckets or with time and the water that rises from within. When you are doing something entirely for somebody else, out of altruism or out of a need to feel some purpose,
what else is there?
What are you good for?
He might have smiled. In any case, the shadowy stretch of the veil across his face altered.
You could try wanting something, for yourself, for its own sake, or getting mad enough about something unfair to decide to do something about it.
She considered it. So strangely attractive. Find something worth fighting for, then fight for it.
But what?
He blinked sleepily.
Dr. Lady Lizzie. If you come to that understanding, you will have exceeded the accomplishments of fully half of humanity. And now, please excuse me. It will be day before long, and I am going to look for some dry wood for the signal fire.
She sat on the beach beside the gauge and watched the sun go down. The wind off the water grew chill. The sand underneath her stayed warm. The gauge spoke before she did.
Do you want to wind up like Maggot Man back there? That's what service to the unappreciative gets you. Ask a gauge how he knows.
She decided not to.
What if you don't have anything but service?
She asked starkly. There was a silence. The stars burned through it, empty and serene as Lizzie wished she could be.
I had a family for a time as well,
said the gauge over the hush of the waves.
You?
Lizzie's expression of confusion was making her forehead itch.
But you are—
Gauges are born before we're made,
said the gauge.
The wizard needs something to take apart, to animate the shell when she puts it back together again.
By the Emperor's wings,
Lizzie said softly.
I volunteered.
She stared at him, rude though it was. The light of the moons made blue ripples on his hide.
Well,
the gauge said reasonably,
would you want something like me around if it hadn't decided it wanted to be made and serve you?
Were you dying? Lizzie covered her mouth with her hands. She was catching rudeness from these foreigners.
Not yet, but I needed to live long enough to exact a kind of justice for my family.
Lizzie hadn't heard the dead man come up behind her. His voice made her jump.
I did live for service, very like you, and then the service was taken from me.
He thumped a pile of sticks down on the sand.
In this life, one cannot rely on anything.
What kept you going past that point?
For me, the dead man said, it was also revenge.
The gauge had called it justice. Lizzie asked, revenge for your caliph? The naive might have mistaken his bark of pain for a laugh.
For my daughters,
he said,
and my wife.
Lizzie couldn't think what to say and said nothing for so long that the dead man collected himself and went on.
That desire kept me alive long enough for others to assert themselves.
The gauge tilted his polished head. It gleamed with a soft luster in the tropic dark.
Revenge led me to become a gauge,
he admitted.
Since then, I have not met anything that could put a stop to me. So, here I am.
Is that the only effective purpose? The only way to make a space for yourself in the world that is not serving someone else's whim? Lizzie asked. Vengeance?
It is the worst one,
the gauge replied.
But it's something to go forward on.
I don't have anyone to punish. Not even the parents who had abandoned her, she realized. For how do you punish those who are dead and gone? But she realized also that she could never make herself good enough, small enough, useful enough to lure them home, because they were dead, and they were gone. All this for family, Lizzie said, and felt that expression push her mouth thin. She was right, you know. This is the only power of her own that she would ever have had.
Yes,
said the gauge quietly.
I know.
He was silent for a moment or two.
Then a harder question. What would you be beyond a servant?
The dead man asked her.
What else would you seek?
Lizzie shrugged. I am not giving up my service. I am useful where I am.
What does your soul crave, though, besides being useful?
There was enough light now to see him shift slightly from foot to foot. Morning was coming. I suppose the first thing I seek is what I am seeking. He touched his nose through the veil, which she thought signified a smile.
Write me a letter when you find it.
You're not staying? He shrugged. The gauge rolled his enormous shoulders, as if settling his tattered homespun more comfortably. Lizzie would have to see if the Emperor's gratitude for the sapphires in her pack would extend to a new raw silk robe for the brazen man. He didn't turn his polished metal leg, but Lizzie had a sense that he was looking at the dead man fondly.
Not here,
the gauge supplied for his partner.
He's seeking something else.
He waited a moment, watching a pale line creep across the bottom of the sky.
You could come with us. We're short a naturalist.
He's seeking a home, she thought. Does the destination matter, or is the value in the journey and whom you make it with? Let me think about it, she said, and watched the auspicious voyage's silhouette approach across the broken mirror of the lagoon.
Lavi Tidhar. I had to think hard about whether it was proper to include one of Lavi Tidhar's tales of guns and sorcery, featuring the bizarre and often ultra-violent adventures of Goril of Galyrus, a gunslinger and addict, in a world full of evil sorcery and monstrous creatures. Did a story without swords belong in a sword and sorcery anthology? But swords are no swords. The Goral stories are true to the spirit of sword and sorcery, and their antecedents are clear. There's the strong influence of Stephen King's gunslinger stories, obviously, but equally strong are the traces of C.L. Moore, Michael Moorcock, Jack Vance, and Robert E. Howard. The Goral stories especially remind me of Howard's early Conan the Barbarian stories. What they are is almost the pure essence of sword and sorcery. Violent, action-packed, paced like a runaway freight train, politically incorrect and socially unredeemable, in your face. They're also a lot of fun. And yet another example, along with the work of many of the other writers here, of the interesting and sometimes surprising directions this particular subgenre is evolving in as we progress deeper into the 21st century. So let yourself be swept along with Goral on his latest dark and twisted quest, but buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride. Further adventures of Goral can be found in the chapbook novella Goral and the Pot-Bellied God and in the collection Black God's Kiss. Lavi Tidhar grew up on a kibbutz in Israel, has traveled widely in Africa and Asia, and has lived in London, the South Pacific island of Vanuatu, and Laos. After a spell in Tel Aviv, he's currently living back in England again. He is the winner of the 2003 Clark Bradbury Prize, awarded by the European Space Agency, was the editor of Michael Marshall Smith, The Annotated Bibliography, and the anthologies A Dick and Jane Primer for Adults, the three-volume The Apex Book of World Science Fiction series, and two anthologies edited with Rebecca Levine, Jews vs. Aliens and Jews vs. Zombies. He is the author of the linked story collection Hebrew Punk and, with Nir Yaniv, the novel The Tel Aviv Dossier and the novella chapbooks An Occupation of Angels, Cloud Permutations, Jesus and the Eightfold Path, and Martian Sands. A prolific short story writer, his stories have appeared in Interzone, Asimov's Science Fiction, Clark's World, Apex Magazine, Strange Horizons, Postscripts, Fantasy Magazine, Nanonymous, Infinity Plus, Eon, The Book of Dark Wisdom, 14 Bureau, Old Venus, and elsewhere, and have been translated into seven languages. His novels include The Bookman and his two sequels, Camera Obscura and The Great Game. Osama, a novel, which won the World Fantasy Award as the year's best novel in 2012, The Violent Century, and A Man Lies Dreaming. His most recent book is a big, multifaceted science fiction novel, Central Station.
Waterfalling, A Guns and Sorcery Novelette by Lavi Tidhar. 1. Gorel of Goliris rode slowly, half delirious in the saddle of his grawl. The creature lumbered beneath him, moving sluggishly. It was a multi-legged beast native to the sands of Mescatel, which lay far to the south. Its tough carapace would turn a pleasing green in sunlight, as it depended on the solar rays for sustenance. But right now its skin was a dark and unhealthy-looking mottled gray, as the storm clouds had been amassing steadily over the deadlands, and the creature was starved of nutrition, just like its master, in his own way, was. Its tail was raised like the stem of a flower, the better to catch moisture in the air, the sting at its end naked like a spur. They were much alike, master and beast. Hardy, obstinate, durable, and deadly. Gorel's head hung limp on his chest. His gums hurt and his eyes felt fused shut, and everything ached. His hands shook uncontrollably. Withdrawal. He needed it. He needed the black kiss. What drove him into the deadlands was a mixture of heartache, desire, and need. Somewhere far behind him lay the Black Tor, and its enigmatic master, the Dark Lord whom Gorel knew only as Kettle. The avian mage was a small, slight being, his fragile bones like those of a bird. The two had been together when Great Falanget fell, and the river Tiamet flooded, its god dead. Kettle had used Gorel, and Gorel could not forgive his one-time lover for that betrayal. His journey since had taken him far and wide, to the great cemetery of Kuralen, where the dead still walk, and to the Zulwarai Mountains, where the remnants of an ancient war still littered the glaciers with deadly, unexploded ordnance. What drove him always was his quest. The search for lost Goliris, that greatest of empires, the biggest and most powerful the world had ever known. His home, from which he had been taken as a child, to which he must return and claim his throne. Yet in all the world, in all of his searching, throughout the long years, he had never found a trace of his homeland, as though, he sometimes thought in dark moments, it had been erased entirely from the memory of all living beings. But the world was large, infinite, some even claimed, and Gorel would not rest until he found it once again. Goliris. Heartache, then, and need. Yet, what of desire? It had happened long before, in the jungle lands where the Urinodag, the ghouls of the bush, haunt the unwary traveler in the thicket, where the smell of rotten leaves and decay fills the still air, where a village once stood, where Gorel had come in his search, only to encounter the twin goddesses, Shar and Shalin, who bit him, laughing, with the black kiss. And even as he murdered them both, and all their followers, their curse was in him, and he was forever hooked. God's dust. But there were no gods in the Deadlands. There were barely any human habitations to attract them, no subsequent illicit transaction of pleasure for faith. And Gorel was driven on blindly, across a land cracked with drought, under a black sky, driven as much away as towards, growing weak, growing delirious. And in his delirium tremens, he remembered. He remembered Goliris. 2. The great towers of dread Goliris rose like an infection out of the fertile ground. They were not so much built as cultivated, planted there in eons past by the Magus Emperor Gon, the Fungimancer, where he had bought these spores, at what cost, or in what far-flung corner of the great empire of Goliris, was lost to the mists of time. But the towers grew, tall, graceful stems with bulbous caps, gills protruding, and a small army of wizard gardeners tending to their constant maintenance. Goliris, Mother City, sat atop the shores of a great ocean. Its black ships, unequaled in all the world, departed from its shores to all corners and returned laden with goods and pillage. The hot, humid air was cooled by the sea breeze, and in its wide avenues and canals there strode, flew, and swam the ambassadors of 1,000 races, come to pay tribute. Gorel remembered standing at the top of the palace, holding his father's hand. The room was cool and dark, and through the gills one could see the ocean spread out to the horizon, where a blood-red sun was slowly setting. Its dying light illuminated the great fleet, black sails raising overhead the 7-pointed star flag of Goliris. "Where are they going, father?" the young Gorel had asked. "To conquer new lands," his father said. "To further spread the fame and power of Goliris." "Gorel, one day, all this will be yours. For untold generations our bloodline held pure and strong, commanding empire. To rule is your destiny, as it was mine. Will you be ready?" The young Gorel held his father's hand and stared out to sea. The thought of his future, the terrible responsibility, both excited and frightened him. But he could not disappoint his father. could not reveal his inner turmoil. "Yes," he said. "Yes, father, I will be ready." "Good boy," his father said. Then he scooped him in his arms, and for one brief, wondrous moment, Gorel felt warm and safe and loved. But already their downfall was underway, and that terrible night came not long after, though he could no longer remember the exact sequence of events, what followed what. He was only a boy, and they had schemed in secret, in the shadows, the mages of Goliris, servants burning with a hatred of mastery. He remembered that awful night, the screams, the cruel laughing faces, the stench of wizardry. Then he was taken from his home, from his world, from all that he knew and loved, transported in the blink of an eye, away from there, the screams still echoing in his ears, and that awful smell, until he woke and found himself in a foreign land, by the side of a hill, and he was crying, for he was only a boy. Now he lolled in the saddle, and his hands caressed the six guns hanging on his sides. He had fashioned them himself, and each bore the seven-pointed stars of Goliris. The land he found himself in as a boy was called the Lower Kidron, and the couple who had found and adopted him were gunsmiths. In that wild, untamed land, the boy Gorel learned the ancient way of the gun, and it was from there that he set out on his journey, to claim back his ancient throne. Though the journey had been taking longer than anticipated, and though he had killed many on the way, he was no closer to his goal. Overhead, the clouds amassed. Somewhere, no doubt, the avian called Kettle was planning the next stage in his inexplicable conquest of this part of the world. There had always been dark mages, and they were always bent on conquest. Yet there was something different about Kettle, a hidden purpose, as though he alone could see some grand and troubling design no one else could discern. But this was no longer Gorel's concern. In truth, he had a job, and despite all the current setbacks, he was intent on following it through. The job was simple, as such jobs usually were. Find a man, and then kill him. And Gorel was good at the first, and very, very good at the second. 3. The client had tracked Gorel down at an abandonment on the edge of the Deadlands. He was, unusually, an apocryta. The apocryta were benign parasites, starting off small, attaching to a human host's lower abdomen, and gradually growing with their hosts until reaching puberty, when they began discarding and changing their humans with some frequency. Other than that unfortunate habit, the apocryta were considered a highly civilized species, with a fine taste in wine and music, and an almost fanatical devotion to the writing of poetry. What one was doing this far away from their natural habitat, a small monarchical feudatory state on the edge of the Yanivian desert, Gorel had no idea, but nor did he care. "I say," the apocryta said, "are you the gunslinger fellow?" Gorel was sitting down with a small cup of Draken, that rare wine, from the far western principality of Kir Bel, which is made by slowly bleeding the indentured tree sprites of that place and fermenting their blood. He stared at the apocryta and made a noncommittal grunting sound and struck a match to light his cigar. "Depends who's asking," he said at last. The apocryta sat down opposite without being invited. He clicked his fingers for service and gruffly ordered, "Whatever that gentleman is drinking." The server, a grave wraith from Kuralen, gave an ugly leer but fetched the drink without comment. The apocryta had nodal growths spread over the human host's body, and its own large, black sack-like mass was fused to the man's back and spread round his hips to the front. "There's a man," the apocryta said.
"There usually is," Gorel allowed.
"He stole something from me," the apocryta said.
The goods would most likely be spoiled by now, but that's immaterial. What is important is that a message is sent. Do you understand?
What's in it for me? Gorel said.
The Apocryta shrugged. From his bespoke tailored jacket, he took out a small black money bag tied with a string. He pushed it across the table, casually and almost contemptuously, at Gorel. Gorel picked it up, untied it, and stared at the powder inside.
God's dust. The black kiss.
He took a pinch, snorted. It hit him like an open slap to the face, and he rocked back in his seat. Across from him, the Apocryta dust merchant looked at him with that same mild contempt.
You will take the job?
And Gorel said,
Yes.
4. The man he was tracking was hard to find. Gorel's payment had long ago gone up his nose, and now, away from any gods, withdrawal hit him hard. But he was nothing if not a professional. He followed the trail, for even in the Deadlands, there were pockets of habitation, abandonments and ruins, strange little hamlets where the destitute and the near dead sought shelter in isolation. The man he was seeking had used many names, but he only had 4 fingers. He'd lost him several times, but he sensed that he was finally close. Gorel always carried a job through, and so now, delirious, half-starved, and in a thoroughly bad mood, he and his grawl at last approached the ruins of an old stone building which might have once been a temple, though who had built it and for what inexplicable reason here in the middle of the Deadlands, Gorel didn't know. Not that he cared. As he approached, he slipped softly from the grawl's hide. The beast sank gratefully to the ground, folding its legs under itself and withdrawing its head inside the dark carapace. It would remain motionless now until the sun came out again, and it could once again absorb enough energy to bring it into waking. Gorel drew both his pistols. He trod softly on the ground. He crept towards the building. Dark ivy grew in the cracks between the old stones, and inside he could hear murmured voices. The door was nothing but a rotting wooden slab. Gorel kicked it open and went inside, where it was dark and dank. A figure lying on a mattress scrambled up, said, What do you? And stopped.
Devlin Fofinger, Gorel said, grinning.
His hand was around the man's throat. The man's skin felt slimy. His breath came and went through Gorel's palm.
I thought it was you.
Who? What?
Devlin's small eyes peered up at Gorel's face, panicked. Then recognition, followed by shock.
Gorel, is that you?
Still alive, Gorel said dryly.
No, 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 no,
Devlin said, speaking quickly, his hands weaving a dance of denial in the air.
That wasn't my fault. No, no, no. I wasn't even there where the...
There had been figures in the mist, ancient carved totems with malevolent eyes. Buried eyes, they called those stones. Seeing eyes. Gorel's company had wandered through the mist, but every time it closed, men were missing, and the totems had a habit of appearing out of nowhere, looming out of the mist and staring at you, calling to you. Few had survived the Mosina campaign.
You cut a deal with them, Gorel said flatly. They let you live for a price.
He smiled grimly and shoved the gun in Devlin's face.
How many did you sacrifice to the old ones of Mosina? He said.
Beneath him, Devlin Fofinger shook and shivered. Spittle came out of his mouth.
No, 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 no,
he said, in plea or apology. It was hard to tell.
I didn't.
So imagine my surprise when a certain Apocryta merchant cornered me in a bar and mentioned he was looking for a 4-fingered thief. Funny that, I thought. That description tends to stick in one's mind. So I thought to myself, I might take this job. It is good to have friends, isn't it, Devlin? Old friends from the old days. I wondered,
Could it be my old friend, Devlin Fofinga, alive after all these years?
Gorell, it wasn't.
The only thing I don't quite get, Gorell said, is what exactly it was that you stole off that tight-ass merchant. He was surprisingly vague on the details. I only ask because, if it's still worth something, I might not kill you quite so slowly.
His hands shook suddenly as the craving overtook him, and though he tried to cover it, Devlin's small, sharp eyes noticed it, and suddenly the man was grinning.
He never said, did he?
Devlin's rotten teeth sucked what little light there was in the room.
Then come, I will show you, I will, for old time's sake, Gorell.
Gorell's finger tightened on the trigger, and yet he couldn't shoot. The craving was upon him then, and at last, reluctantly, he released Devlin. The man rose swiftly, like a rat.
Come, he said, come.
A second, sturdier door separated the antechamber from the main body of the ruined temple. From his belt, Devlin selected a rusted metal key and unlocked the door. When he pushed it open, the darkness beyond was greater still. Gorell hesitated on the threshold, but he could feel it. It lay thick and hard on the air. It suffocated the breath, tantalizing and rich, the very scent of it almost enough. Almost. But it was never enough. Ablution. Faith. Call it what you will. The curse bestowed upon him by the goddesses Shalin and Shar. Devlin hurried into the darkness, and now lights were coming alive, one by one, small candles being lit along the walls. In the dim light, Gorell could see they were not alone. It was a large room, and the women and men lying on the floor seemed near death. Only the gentle rising and falling of chests gave indication that they still breathed, still retained a tenuous link to life. He could taste God's sorcery in the air, feel keenly the thin membrane between the two worlds stretching. Here. He had crossed it before, and could never truly get back.
What have you done? He said,
but even as he spoke, he already knew the answer.
Come, 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 Devlin said.
His grin was manic, his eyes dancing wildly in his face.
It is waiting. It is ready. It is near.
He took Gorell by the hand. The gunslinger followed him, helpless to resist. They walked deeper into the room, stepping over the sleepers, Devlin putting a finger to his mouth in an exaggerated warning to be quiet. Here and there, groans from the sleepers. One propped herself up and stared at them.
Is it time, Devlin? Is it time yet?
Not for you, Gammy Steele, Devlin cackled. Gammy, Gammy, ugly Gammy, your time is not yet come.
I have money, the woman said. Then, I can get some. I can get more.
Then do so.
Ignoring her, he led Gorell on. The woman's eyes followed them. Then, with a sigh, she lay back down. Gorell could hear her stifled sobs. They came to the end of the hall. Devlin let go of Gorell's hand and knelt down, lighting a semicircle of candles facing the wall. One by one they came alive, and trapped within them was a god. 5. It was chained to the wall with bands of steel. It had the breasts of a woman, the sex of a man. It was naked. The god's eyes were two dark orbs, and its lips were thick and bruised and glistened wetly. There was no hair upon the body, and the god's cock was a small, shriveled thing. Sweat glistened upon the god, as fine as grains of dust. Dust. Gorell knelt before the god. Devlin's hand was on his head, then stroking. Gorell stared at the captive god, and the god stared back through eyes like bottomless holes.
Better than dust, Devlin whispered. You want to know what I stole, Gorell? I took only that which was promised to me. Do you like it, Gorel? I see the mark on you. I can taste your need, old friend, your desire. Do you want it?
Yes, Gorel said. Yes.
Then the black kiss itself is yours for the taking, Gorel of Goliris.
He was no longer fully aware of Devlin. The world contracted to the half-circle of candlelight. Gorel could smell the god, that rancid, sweet, overpowering scent of dust, and he knew he wanted it, needed it, the way he never needed anything else. On hands and knees, slowly, he crept towards the god. If the flames of the candles hurt him, if it burnt his flesh, he didn't know, nor care. The chained god thrashed against his chains, but he was held fast. Dimly, Gorel was aware of the others coming alive, felt their desire joining his. He crawled to the naked god and offered him his lips. The first hit was always the best. Flashes of light, flashes of consciousness. Gorel was fading in and out of the world. Rarely had it been this good, this direct. Even the pain of losing his home, of being vanquished from proud Goliris, the betrayal, the hurt, the fear, they were all gone, and there was only bliss. Flashing images, disconnected from each other, strange sensations, the sweet and sour taste of the god's mouth, a taste of blood and sorcery. He was only briefly aware of hands. Devlin's? Going through his clothes, relieving him of non-essentials, coin and guns. A chuckle, close in his ear, hot, rotting breath. A murmur. Only the first taste is free. None of these things mattered. His lips fastened on the gods. Nothing mattered anymore. Nothing but the black kiss. The terrible kiss of the gods. 6. How long he lay so, he didn't later know. Time did not matter. Nothing did. The dark hall was heaven, the only kind of heaven man could hope for in this world. The dirty mattress that he lay on was his home, grander even than vanished Goliris. He had no need for money, for guns, for knowledge, or desire. All was as it should be, here in the hall of the naked god. The naked god, the chained god. From what dark place did it arise? What primordial bog did it crawl out of, with Fowfinger as his prophet and disciple? It was a question unimportant to Gorel. All questions were. He needed nothing, was nothing. Only dimly, therefore, was he aware at last of someone moving through the bodies of the lost, of shouts and a laugh and steps again, and a hand reaching down and shaking him roughly awake. A voice from far away said, "You stupid fool." Gorel grinned, or tried to. The hand slapped him, once, twice. Gorel tried to hit back, but couldn't lift his hand. The voice said, "Devlin, if he's dead, you're next in line."
"He is alive, alive," a whiny voice replied. "A dead man's no use to me, no use to anyone but the gods beyond the veil."
"Gods," the other voice said. "Save me from gods and their addicts."
You won't hurt him, will you?"
the wheedling voice, Fofinga's voice, said.
"Gorel."
"My God," Devlin said. "Screw Gorel and those who ride with him.
Watch your language, little man. Now get him up and sober. I need him. He's good for nothing but another dose of dust.
Then get me dust, and hurry. My patience is running thin. Hands tugging at Gorel, lifting him. He tried to fight them, but the black kiss was upon him again, and he soon enough subsided.
He'll have to sleep it off. As for the dust,
I'll pay the going rate.
Why didn't you say so to begin with?
Just get him ready, or you'll lose another finger. Darkness, light. He was being carried. The stench of sorcery subsided gradually. Cold water hit him, made him cry out. He was being scrubbed, none too gently, then hit with cold water again. Then something soft, a towel. A voice said,
"Dry yourself. Think you can manage that?"
He wasn't sure. The voice sounded familiar. He dried himself as best he could, hands dragging him, something soft beneath. A bed. No roaches there this time. He slept. When he woke up, the room was bright with light. Gorel blinked back tears.
"Good to see you back in the land of the living," a voice said.
The voice from his dreams, a familiar voice. He sat up and stared at the small man sitting by his bedside. The man gave him a sardonic smile. His left eye was missing and covered by a plain leather patch. His hair was gray and bald along the line of an old scar. He was smoking a thin, homemade cigar. Gorel said,
"Mouser? Were you expecting Fofinga?"
"I was expecting no one."
He examined the smaller man. His fingers bunched into fists.
"You took me from there?"
"I need you functioning." A curious glance.
"When did you—" Gorel shook his head.
"An itinerant god. Far south from here. It's a long story."
Mouser shook his head.
"It's good to see you again, Gorel."
"You too."
Gorel touched his head. It felt sore. His hands, he noticed, were covered in bites. Bedbugs. He scratched half-heartedly.
"I thought you were dead."
His friend merely smiled at that. He said,
"I heard you were around."
"How?"
"Fofinga tried to sell me your guns."
"That little—"
Mouser gestured with his head.
"They're there. Are you fit enough to use them?"
The guns were on the table by the bed, the seven-pointed stars of Golirish shining on their handles. Gorel said,
"I just—"
"Yes?"
"I need just a little bit."
There was silence between them. Mauser's smile evaporated. He took a drag on his cigar, held the smoke in before releasing it. His face was wreathed in blue smoke. He said,
"Perhaps you're no good to me after all."
"Screw you,"
Gorel said. He stood up, reached for his guns. Mauser didn't move. Gorel took the guns, began checking first one, then the other. Mauser smoked and watched. After he was satisfied with the guns, Gorel dressed himself, shaved, and stretched. He didn't think he could stomach any food, but he'd try. When he turned around to Mauser, the smaller man had finished his cigar and in its place was holding a small packet of folded paper. He threw it to Gorel. Gorel caught it, opened it carefully, and took a pinch of dust. He put it up his nose, snorted it, and smiled.
"What's the job?"
he said. 7.
"There's really nothing to it," Mauser said.
They were standing outside the ruined temple. Devlin Fofinga was on his hands and knees in the mud, with Gorel's gun pressed painfully against his forehead.
"Please, Gorel, it's all just a terrible mistake."
Gorel pressed the muzzle of the gun harder against the man's greenish skin.
"I'm listening," he said to Mauser.
"A grab and run, a heist.
You know what it's like."
"Uh-huh. And what's the target?"
Gorel, please, let me go. What happened in Messina wasn't my fault.
Shut up, Gorel said. Mouser? An icon, that's all. Look, are you going to finish him off or what?
Haven't decided.
He could be useful, Mouser said, meditatively.
A thief's no good with just four fingers.
He can still hold a gun, Gorel. You only need one finger to pull a trigger.
So, a rough job.
Did you expect anything else?
Gorel chewed on his cigar.
A religious icon, he said.
You know any other kind?
And where exactly is this icon?
In a temple, Gorel, Mouser said. Isn't that where they usually are?
I see, Gorel said.
He chewed on his cigar, then casually backhanded Devlin on the side of the head with the butt of the gun. The man fell down on the ground holding his face. He stared up in hatred at the muzzle of the gun.
Oh, get up, Gorel said. I'm not going to kill you. Today.
The man slowly got up. He wiped the blood with his fingers, then sucked on them. Gorel looked away in disgust, and Devlin grinned.
You're not? He said.
Hey, it's your lucky day, Mouser said.
You need me, huh?
Gorel shrugged.
Where exactly is this temple? He said.
Ever heard of waterfalling?
No, no, Devlin said.
He shook his head from side to side and began to back away from them.
No, 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 no. I'm not going to, no.
This time it was Mauser's gun pointed at his face. Gorel looked at him, spat out the cigar, and smiled.
Do you want the job? He said. Or not?
His gun pointed unwaveringly at Devlin's face. Was all the answer anyone needed. They rode away from that abandoned place that day. They had left the dying god behind, and its worshippers clustered around it, feeding.
Who knew, Gorel thought.
Perhaps the god would thrive on its worshippers' need. Perhaps it would grow, not diminish, and in years to come that lonely spot would be the birthplace of a new religion. Stranger things have happened. Though Devlin complained bitterly and at length about the loss of his property and its derivative income. They had served together on the ill-fated Messina campaign in the Romango lands far from there. Gorel had been young, had only recently left the lower Kidron. He'd sought employ with a group of mercenaries, each more savage and unruly than the other. They were a group of young bloods with a taste for murder. There was Gorel, and the half-Merlangai, Jericho Moon, and there was Devlin Fofinga. But as tough as they thought they were, nothing could prepare them for the swamps of Messina, where tendrils of fog permeated the air, where the landscape constantly shifted about them, where people simply disappeared. You could not fight what wasn't there. And, separated from the main body of troops, their company sank deeper and deeper into the domain of the old ones. What they were, these things, which haunted the nightmarish swamps, he never learned. All he could remember was a circle of totemic poles rising suddenly out of the fog, hideous, carved faces staring down on them, the eyes alive and glinting. The mouths were cruel slashes, gouged into the wood. When they got hold of you, there was no getting away, and the screams of their victims pierced the fog and the eternal twilight of that place, lasting for hours, all through their slow and terrible sacrifice. It was this that he remembered most of all. The endless screams across the bogs. Only one got away. Devlin got away. He'd not lost so much as a finger. Only later did they realize what terrible bargain the thief had struck with the old ones. How he'd paid for his freedom with his comrades' lives. A rat and a thief and a traitor, and Gorel wanted to kill him, but Mouser was right. They might need him for the job. They rode away from that desolate place and across the deadlands, heading towards the fertile places beyond. Gorel was no fool. He knew when he was being sold a dummy. But he owed Mauser, just as Mauser owed him. And the man had come looking for him, specifically. The truth was, he was curious. He had heard of this place they were traveling to. Waterfalling. 8. They heard it long before they saw it. The great waterfall which gave the city its name fell down from the high plateau of Tarsh, which borders the Deadlands on one side and reaches as far as the Zulwarai Mountains. In those mountains, where the twin and ancient races of the Zul and the Warai had died in their war of complete annihilation, the glaciers provided the water which fed the Nirian. It was a long, wide, and stately river which flowed across that vast distance without undue hurry until reaching the sheer drop of rock that led its water, without warning, to plunge for a great distance down until it hit the sacred pool. It was not so much a pool, of course, as a wide, if miniature, lake. From there, the water flowed more gently, away from the sacred pool, and into a carefully crafted series of canals and waterways, and an ingenious system of locks, around which there formed the numerous islands, embankments, and eights, which formed the sprawling city itself. A rough-hewn path was cut into the side of the mountain, twisting and turning at a steep angle as it rose all the way up to the Tarsh Plateau, allowing any resident of the city, when their time was due, to traverse it to the top of the waterfall. That path was long and tortuous and steep, and yet it was used. It was called the Path of Ascension. The sky was calm. The air smelled fresh and clear. A kingfisher flew against the sky. The color of the water, as one approached, was a startling blue, and against it, the well-ordered flora of the city was in a range of vivid greens. Flowers bloomed everywhere in a cacophony of red and blue and yellow, and their scent filled the air like perfume. The houses were neat and built of wood and stood on stilts, and children ran laughing along the many bridges. It was, in nearly every way, a peaceful and idyllic scene, and it was only mildly spoiled, Gorel felt, by the still, serene, and perfectly preserved corpses in the water. But that came a little later. They approached the city just after dawn. A day's ride away, they had come to Mauser's dead drop. There Gorel found clothes, a stack of weapons that impressed even him, and a small, gaily painted wagon with the legend Mimes on it. Along with the wagon was a donkey. Gorel stared at the donkey. Then he stared at Mauser. All this just happened to be here? It pays to be prepared. But who's doing the paying? Mauser shrugged. Does it matter to you? A client's a client. I don't like the smell of this job much, Gorel said. Mauser grinned and tossed him a twisted packet of paper. Gorel unfolded it and stared at the powder. Besides, Mauser said, it's an old city. The foundations go back. Who knows what arcane knowledge they have hidden there? Perhaps they would know of your homeland. It was bait. Gorel knew it. Mauser knew it. Fofinga, for sure, knew it. Yet that didn't make it untrue. Gorel took a pinch, only a pinch, of dust. Just enough to quiet the craving. All right, he said. But what about the wagon? No one is going to believe we're anything other than what we are, or fail to notice the weapons. I've got that covered too, Mauser said. Gorel stared at him in suspicion as the other man reached into a hidden bag the color of bark and brought out three amulets. He handed one to Devlin and one to Gorel, and kept one for himself. Gorel stared at the amulet. It was made of warm metal and was light to the touch, and intricately carved with circles and lines that seemed to spell something to him, if only he could read their meaning. He knew what it was, of course. It reeked of sorcery. They're one use, Mauser said, almost apologetically. But they'll be enough to get us through. Just don't put it on until we get close to the city.
And this was provided?
Mouser shrugged. It's not too late to back out, he said, if you don't want the job.
And what would you do without me?
No one's irreplaceable, Gorell. They stared at each other, but there was no real question about the outcome. The next morning, early, three humble mimes made their way in their gaudily painted cart across the plain to the city of Waterfalling. They were pulled by the small and patient donkey. They were not much to look at, three weather-beaten entertainers brought down by life on the road. One of them was missing a finger. They rode in silence, and they could hear the city long before they reached it, the never-ceasing sound of an incredible volume of water falling from a great height until it hit the down below. There were always rainbows over Waterfalling. The constant spray of water in the air broke the light into joyous color, while at night one witnessed the silvery form that comes when moonlight interacts with that same fog. To get to the city, one had to cross the largest canal, which served as an effective moat around the city, barring invaders, and it was there that Gorell first saw the corpses. They floated just underneath the surface, their eyes open and serene, their noses pressed against the surface of the water as though ready, at any moment, to rise through and resume their lives. But their skins were leached white, near translucent, and their depth never varied, though sometimes they were pushed by the current as more corpses came down from...
The sacred pool,
Devlin whispered, and shuddered.
Shut up, fool.
Gorell's hand was on the butt of his gun. He hoped the enchantment would do its work and conceal them. There were guards on the only gate, which blocked entry to the only bridge into the city. The guards were Ebong mercenaries, large beetle-like creatures with great helmet-like heads as opaque as polished black stone, and they held rifles.
Stop!
The mimes stopped obediently.
Purpose of visit?
We are but humble entertainers seeking to ply our humble trade.
Do a mime.
Excuse me?
I said, do a mime.
The next 5 minutes were some of the worst of Gorell's life, which was saying something. He, Mouser, and Devlin pranced and pretended to be trapped in invisible glass jars, and to climb invisible ladders, and to go down invisible stairs, and all in silence. They were terrible. Every moment Gorell expected the ruse to be discovered, and to enter a deadly shootout with the Ebong. They were not a race he liked to tangle with, at least not without gaming the odds. When they were finished, however, there was a short hiss of noxious air which, for the Ebong, must have passed for enthusiastic clapping.
You can go. Warn you, though, not much call for mimes round here.
And the rents are steep,
added his colleague.
Ask me, you'd be better off striking for the lowlands, said a third. Besides, you want to watch out you don't hear the call.
His colleagues turned their black helmet heads on him at that, and the mercenary slunk away, or as much as an Ebong could ever be said to slink. The three mimes thanked the guards humbly and rode through the open gate and across the bridge and into the city. And Gorell could hear it now, and he realized he had been hearing it for some time, all through their approach to the city, though it was clearer now. A sort of faint crystal peal. A little sound of summoning, just at the edge of hearing. 9. Once they were inside, the talismans began to lose their power. The three would-be robbers found a ramshackle inn that stood on an 8 in the confluence of two of the smaller canals. There they checked their weapons while Mouser outlined the plan. How and when Gorell had met Mouser was a long and not entirely interesting story. It was during that unfortunate episode with the demon priests of Krog. Needless to say, both of them had barely escaped with their lives, and Mouser still had a neat little scar to show for it. Where he came from, Gorell was never entirely sure. He was a rare white face of a race of barbarians who lived high in the snow-peaked mountains of the Bayas. Gorell trusted him, as much as he could be said to trust anyone. Devlin he didn't trust at all, but then the man's untrustworthiness was a sort of assurance in itself. The city was strange. It was clean and prosperous and ordered, a little haven of peace in a violent world. He had had a chance to examine the corpses in the canals as they wended their slow way to the inn. There were the bodies of many races in the water, human and avian and Merlangai, Ebong and numerous others. Who could tell where they had come from or how long they had been lying there, submerged, perfectly preserved in the cold water that flowed from the sacred pool? Even as he watched, he'd see a new body arrive from upstream, fed into the system of canals until it found a place and there remained, suspended. And always, at the edge of hearing, there was that faint peal of a bell, a sort of muted laughter, an invitation. And as he watched, he saw a woman stop in the middle of her shopping and drop her bags and stand transfixed. Her child stood beside her, a little girl. A beatific smile filled the woman's face. Then she began to walk away, leaving behind both her shopping and her child. The little girl began to run after her mother, but the woman paid her no mind, and a shopkeeper and a flower seller with a kindly face held the girl from following and tried awkwardly to comfort her. The mother went away. The plan was simple. There was only one god in Waterfalling. The god of the waterfall had many small temples scattered throughout the city, and one main one. The grand temple occupied the entirety of an island high upstream. The path to the drop passed close to it as it led farther up until it reached the plateau. It was not heavily guarded, for who would dare disturb the temple of the god in its own domain? "The icon is inside the temple," Mauser said. "It is a small, blue, amorphous shape faintly resembling a human figure. It is made of ice 7. Some say it holds the soul of the god within it, others that it is merely an artistic representation. We are going to go on the first assumption. The job's to get in and get the icon. The ultimate target's assassination," Devlin said, and leered. Gorell stared at the two of them, Devlin's ugly grin and Mauser's grim determination. "Assassination? Come on, Gorell. It's not like it would be the first god you've killed. In fact, you're almost uniquely qualified. Is that why I'm here? Would you rather be somewhere else? Are we keeping you from some urgent appointment?" Gorell lit a cigar and stared at the two of them. He began to wonder just who the mysterious Apocryta merchant who'd first hired him was, and just how exactly Mauser had then found Gorell. But Mauser was right. A job was a job, and besides, Gorell had his own purpose in being there. So he just nodded, affably enough, and said, "I'm going to look around. You two try to stay out of trouble." "I think the trouble part's going to come later," Mauser said, and Devlin sucked on his wet, green teeth noisily and leered at Gorell. He left them there, checking and cleaning the weapons. 10. Of course he'd known about the god of the waterfall. 11. Gorell was no fool, and the fame of waterfalling had spread far and wide. Now he followed the path of ascension. Initially, the road was paved as he followed city thoroughfares and traversed small bridges. People stared after him but said nothing. He saw the temple then, a large, imposing complex of beautiful white stone. He skirted the temple and soon reached the first incline, and there the city stopped and the path proper began. It was cut into the very rock, and it rose steeply at a sharp incline. Small pebbles rolled underfoot. The climb was slow and hard, but there were places to stop and rest along the way, small alcoves cut into the rock. Gorell did not hurry. He enjoyed the climb, the cooler air up there, and when he turned he could look down on Waterfalling and far beyond, across the plains and to the deadlands where, far away, loomed the Black Tor. He thought of Kettle then. There wasn't a day gone past when he didn't think about Kettle. As he climbed, he saw almost no people. One he passed, and he realized with some surprise it was the woman he had seen earlier. She was resting in one of the alcoves, with that same happy, vacant look on her face. She didn't seem to see him, and he walked on, discomfited. The call. No. The call. He could hear it more clearly now, and as the path wound its way up and up and up, he could hear the thunder of the waterfall and feel the spray of its roar on his face, and his eyes were dazzled by an explosion of rainbows. Come, come, said the call, but it was faint, still. It was not meant for him, but for another. Gorel of Goliris traversed the path of ascension until he reached, at last, the plateau of Tarsh, where the Nerian River flows until it reaches the escarpment. He saw it all now. He stood in that place called the Drop. The river moved almost sluggishly as it neared the edge. A series of rocks slowed down the flow of water, and it tumbled over the edge almost reluctantly. When it did, it became a great thundering waterfall. Way down below, he could see the mist rising out of the impact of the water into the sacred pool. He stood there for a long time. When the woman at last reached the drop, she seemed as beatific as before. Though her journey must have been physically exhausting for her, nevertheless there was no change in her demeanor. For a long moment she merely stood there, smiling that vacant, enigmatic smile. She seemed indifferent to or unaware of Gorel's presence. Then she took one step and another, until Gorel felt compelled to shout a warning, for she was headed straight for the sheer drop beyond which was the fall. But the woman ignored him as though he weren't there, and when he went to stop her, she shrugged him away, not angrily, but the way one would shrug off a mild irritant. Come, come. For one moment the call was so clear that it overwhelmed Gorel's senses. Too late, he saw the woman step to the edge of the rocks. Then she took one step more, and just like that, she was gone. He crawled to the edge and peered over. He saw her fall. She fell without grace through the air until the waterfall claimed her, the water engulfing her unto itself. Then she was gone from sight. Gorel of Goliris remained at the drop for a long while more, and his thoughts were troubled. He was not idle, though. When he was done, he wended his way down the path and returned to the inn, where his two companions waited. It was night by then. The stars shone down cold and indifferent, and the air was filled with the stench of the Black Kiss. He realized he had not needed a hit since they got to the city. It was all about them, as natural and as plentiful as water. And he realized they were all, here, as much in slavery to the kiss as he was. When the city began, when the first jumper jumped, that no one knew. The city grew, and the god with it. The city prospered, and the god with it. They fed on each other. And now someone wanted the god dead. When he had returned, Mouser and Devlin were ready. There was no need for speech. All three men were armed. They stepped out lightly, and only a fleeting egret saw them pass into the night. 12. Later, when he was running, with Devlin lying on the canal bank with half his brains blown out, and Mouser on his hands and knees trying to crawl away from the speakers to water as they closed in on him, there was no one to see him then, too. The good people of Waterfalling knew when to close their doors and when to draw the blinds on their windows, and the whole city lay silent and slumbering in the moonlight. The job was botched from the very beginning. The very air of the city had whispered that this was all folly. Nevertheless, they went in. Over the bridge, into the temple complex, where the waft of incense and the chanting of priests could be heard, where ducks and geese congregated in the canals where the dead men lay. Deep into the temple, searching for the inner sanctum. A novice surprised them, innocently watering lilies, and Mouser shot her, the blast echoing loudly over the islet. Devlin shot two further novices as they emerged, blinking off sleep to see what was happening. The blue icon was there just as Mouser said it would be, a small and amorphous representation of a vaguely human shape that could have been a waterfall. The three men made for the idol. The speakers to water emerged then, the priests of the god of the waterfall, dressed in flowing white robes with water flowers in their hair. Their eyes were vacant, and they moved in perfect unison. In their hands, they held swords of ice. Their lips moved as one. They said, "You shall not steal."
"Screw that,"
Devlin said, and he began firing. Blades of ice moved in perfect harmony, deflecting shots. Devlin screamed in rage and snatched the shotgun from his back and fired, once, twice, until he hit one of the speakers in the guts. The speaker collapsed to the ground, but his lips still moved, and with his fellow speakers he said, "You shall not steal!" Gorel and Mouser spread out, and it was then that he saw the corpses. They emerged out of the water, out of the dank canal. One at first, and then another, and another. Humans, Ebong, two Merlongai, an avian shivering water off her feathers. The perfectly preserved bodies in the water. Now their eyes opened, and a single force animated them, and they reached into the canal and pulled out blade-sharp staffs of ice. They advanced on the three men.
"You bring swords?" Devlin screamed. "What good are damn swords against guns?"
Gorel fired. He fired cleanly, methodically, without emotion. It was a scientific sort of extermination, a matter of numbers, not blood. The creatures in the water must have been living once, but they lived no longer, and the corpses were only that. He shot not to kill, but to destroy, inflicting damage on skulls and kneecaps and finger bones, shooting to disable, if possible, to annihilate. He was good at what he did. He had to be, to have survived this long. Perhaps he wasn't the best. The world was filled with the stories of legendary gunmasters, such as Six Gun Smell of the Upper Kidron, or Yi Shang the Unbeatable, who killed the sea serpent, Og, or the wizard, Der Fliegenmelker, who collected the heads of his enemies and whose mound of skulls was said to be taller than a mountain by the time of his disappearance. But these were just that, legends, stories told around the campfire in hushed voices. They were of some distant past, and Gorel was of the present. As far as he was concerned, he was the best, and would remain so until someone finally managed to shoot him down, if they ever did. He wouldn't have given them odds. The men kept pulling more guns out of the bags they'd brought with them, but more and more of the bodies came, and their swords of ice flashed cold in the moonlight, and Devlin cried out when one just missed slicing off his arm, and Gorel was pushed back, back as they came, and Mouser fired with a calm intensity on his face, like a card player calculating the odds of his hand. There was so very little blood. The things that climbed out of the water had been in there too long, Gorel thought. What ran in their veins, if it ran at all, was a sort of amethyst liquid, and as it left their bodies, it congealed and tried to slither back into the canal. "We can't hold them forever," Mouser shouted. All the while, the speakers to water were chanting, their lips moving in unison, the canal dwellers between them and the three shooters.
"Cover me,"
Gorel shouted. Then he was running, bodies blasted on either side of him as Devlin and Mouser fired. Gorel slid in the purple ichor, and his forward momentum pushed him along until he bounced off an ebong and was through. He came right up to the speakers in one fluid motion and with his two guns drawn. For a moment, he looked into their eyes. What he saw in them, it was hard to say. He pulled both triggers. With the fall of the speakers, the onslaught abruptly ceased. The preserved corpses did not fall, but remained standing, motionless and eerie in the moonlight. The three men looked at one another, their ears still ringing with the sound of gunshots. Then they moved as one, racing for the prize, their enemies forgotten. Gorell got to it first. He snatched the blue idol a moment before Mouser. When he turned, Devlin had his guns pointed at the two of them, and he was grinning his ugly grin.
"It's about time we settled this," Devlin said.
Mouser fired, but Devlin was quicker, and Mouser was thrown back, hurt. The other shot missed Gorell. He had moved behind Mouser, and the shot meant for him missed. Devlin's smile dissipated, and Gorell's smile bloomed, and he fired. Devlin's body fell back, and he lay on the bank of the canal, his skull blown to pieces and his brain leaking slowly into the water. Gorell was briefly pleased at a job finally brought to conclusion.
"Gorell," Mouser said.
He was still alive. The shot had opened an ugly wound in his stomach, and he was trying to hold his intestines in.
"Help me."
Gorell held up the icon. He said,
"How do you destroy it?"
"I don't know."
He said, "Who bought you off, Mouser? Who hired you?
Does it matter?"
"It does to me."
"It was him. It was that mage from the Black Tor. The one who brought down Falanget and killed Tarat. He said you—"
Cold fury rose in Gorell.
"Kettle,"
he said.
"Kettle sent you?"
"Gorell, please."
The speakers to water Gorell had shot rose up from the ground then. They looked at Gorell with broken eyes, and all the corpses that had risen from the water turned as one and focused their attention on the two men, the one living and the one dying. Then the speakers spoke. They said,
"Gorell of Goliris."
Mouser said,
"Help me."
The preserved corpses advanced one step, then another.
"We know you, Gorell of Goliris. Come now, come."
"Help me, Gorell, please."
Gorell ran. He ran without destination in mind, yet the destination had always been there, waiting for him. He was not followed. Few saw him pass. And yet his feet led him inexorably upwards, and the voice in his head grew stronger and stronger until it was like a raging storm, and it said,
"Come to me, come."
It knew his name. In his hand, the blue idol was still. Gorell's feet would not obey him. He felt a calmness descend on him then, and his face assumed a beatific aspect. He came to the path of ascendance and began to climb it.
"It has been many centuries since I had last encountered a man of Goliris," the voice said. "You know of Goliris?"
His lips moved, but whether sound emerged or not was immaterial. It was night. He was alone on the path. Behind him, Devlin lay dead, Mouser dying. Another botched job in a long line of such. None of it mattered to Gorell.
"Many have heard of, yet none had seen Goliris," said the voice in his head. "You seek it still?"
"Always."
"Yet now you must come to rest, Gorell. Let go of desire, of need. I will be all that you require."
"No,"
his lips protested. His legs obeyed the orders of the god.
Tell me how to find my home."
"Sooner or later, all things must come to an end, Gorell of Goliris. All empires pass."
"Including yours?"
But the god was not amused by the retort. Gorell climbed and climbed and climbed. The physical effort of the rise meant nothing to him, for now he truly was under the black kiss, and every fiber of his being was bliss, and he was happy as a man could ever be. Yet still he resisted. Yet still he fought the insidious black kiss of the god. And still his feet led him on, step by inexorable step, until he found himself once more standing at the drop. The waterfall thundered nearby. Rainbows of moonlight sparkled in the rising cloud of spray.
"Come to me, Gorel of Goliris," said the god. "Come."
There was no resisting the call. And yet he dallied. And it was good, he thought, that he had prepared himself for this eventuality. And he busied himself with the things that he had left there, at the drop, earlier, for just such an eventuality. And the voice of the god grew mistrustful in his head, and it said,
"What are you doing?"
But Gorel did not answer. And the call of the god grew stronger and more insistent, until there was no resisting it further. For one fleeting moment, Gorel thought of all the countless lives that had come here before him, had worn the rock smooth with the passage of their feet. Then he, too, took those last few finite steps to the edge and fell to his doom. 13.
"What did you do?" said the god.
14. The first impact was the worst. He hit the roaring mass of water on his way down, and all his protective clothing couldn't stop him from feeling the impact. Then the ropes tied to his harness pulled, and he shot upwards, then back down, and impacted again. And then the bouncing slowed, until he could at last control his descent.
"What did you do?"
roared the god. The water fell and fell and tried to push him down, down, down into the sacred pool, and the rocks beat at him. But Gorel welcomed the pain and used it to his advantage. The kiss no longer held him. The god's call was never meant to last beyond the final drop, and now it had no more power to hold Gorel in thrall. Slowly, slowly, he released more rope, hoping it would hold, and he lowered himself down the cliff.
"Tell me," Gorel demanded. "Tell me what you know of Goliris." "Then join me. Become a part of me, and you will know all that I know." "No." "Please," the god said. "Please."
How long he journeyed this way, he didn't know. The bottom was a blur far down below. The cliff rose impossibly high overhead. At last he found it. He hit empty air and flailed. Then he was through the screen of water and inside a hollow cave, hidden behind the water. He took off the harness and fell to the dry stone floor. He lay there for some time, breathing heavily.
"You have come to kill me," the voice accused.
It sounded frightened now.
"Tell me what I want to know."
It was a natural cave in the rock, Gorel saw. Once, millennia ago, it had been explored, and the skeletons of humans and Ebong still remained in recesses in the wall. Then it had become a temple of a sort. An altar sat against the far wall, and on it was a crude stone figure. Something living hid in the dark behind it, a creature like a ferret or a water rat. Baleful eyes glared at Gorel from the shadows, but he paid them no mind. He held the blue icon in his hand.
"Tell me," he said. "I could only show you."
His mind flickered then. It went through countless rapid lives. He saw an Ebong mercenary arrive at the cliffs and look down, curiously, for the first time. An avian flying overhead who plunged down towards the water with a glad cry. An expedition of vanished Zul, searching for a weapon, who had come upon the place and fell victim to the call. Water-dwelling Merlongai, who swam down the Nerian, a hunting party until, too late, they too became a part of the god. He saw the crude village underneath grow and prosper, become a town, then at last a city. The dead resided in the water, their eyes forever open. he saw people drawn from all over to this city, where the kiss lay like an enchantment over the streets and houses. It was a small price to pay for happiness, he thought. From time to time, some would hear the call and climb the path until they were one with their God. It was a small price to pay.
Do you see? Join me, said the God. Show me Goliris.
Then he saw it. A small figure trudging in from the Deadlands, a sorcerer of Goliris, and Gorel knew him then. It was one of his father's servants, a minor war mage with the fleet, just another face in the corridors of the palace, a man who might have once smiled politely at the boy, this future king. He came and he dwelled in the city for some time. Then he heard the call and heeded it. And Gorel saw deep into his heart, for the man was with the God now, and he saw the hatred and the loathing deep within the man's mind, and he saw that the hatred and loathing were directed inwards, at the traitor's own self. He saw then the sorcerers of Goliris gathered in a dark room, saw them plot the downfall of the royal family. He saw himself, the boy, taken while his father was murdered, saw his mother cry, but soundlessly, and he saw the empty throne, and cobwebs, and bleached skulls.
How will I find it again? He said, demanded of this ghost.
And only the faint echo came back.
You never will.
A great fury took hold of Gorel of Goliris then, and for a time he knew not where he was. Gradually he came back to awareness, and the god's voice, weak, panicked, demanded over and over,
What did you do? What did you do?
Gorel sat there in the cave, cross-legged, and looked out at the waterfall. But the water, strangely, seemed to grow less fierce. Its flow was easing. The screen of water slowly parted, and the god's voice cried,
What did you do? You are killing me.
But Gorel had done nothing. Beside him, the small blue icon was slowly melting. The waterfall was dying. As less and less water fell, Gorel could now look out from the cave into clear air. At last it was all over, and he went to the edge and looked down and saw the pool, no longer sacred, and the corpses below lying still in the water. He looked up then and saw no water falling. Behind him, behind the altar, the mindless creature that might have been a ferret or a water rat growled, but Gorel paid it no mind. He sat, cross-legged, on the floor and lit a cigar. And he waited. 15. The small, delicate shape fluttered in the air before coming to rest inside the cave. It leaned against one wall and crossed its arms and cocked its head and looked at Gorel of Goliris.
Kettle, Gorel said. Gorel? It was you? You set it up, from the beginning. It was so convenient, how that traitor found me, how Mauser just happened to be in the right place at the right time. I would have asked you, but you would have turned me down. You lie to me. From the very start, you always lie.
A look of pain crossed the avian's face.
Gorel, you'd tell me you love me? You know how I feel. And yet you'd use me? Isn't that what love is?
The Lord of the Black Tor looked at Gorel of Goliris, and Gorel of Goliris looked away, so that Kettle would not see his tears.
What was it all for? I needed a distraction. Something to focus the god of the waterfall's attention on. Something crude and obvious and effective. You used me as bait. Yes. And all the meanwhile, my engineers had done their work. We damned the Nerian.
my army dug a new channel for the river.
And starved the waterfall.
Yes.
Clever.
Kettle shrugged.
Why?
Gorel said.
Why? Yes.
Kettle looked at Gorel of Goliris, and his eyes were filled with pain.
There's a war coming, he said.
And an enemy against which even I am helpless. I have been trying to consolidate territories, to prepare, Gorel.
I need you.
I need you by my side.
Help me. Come back with me.
Never.
Will I ever be able to apologize enough?
I love you.
Gorel did not reply. After a time, the small and delicate figure of the mage flew away. After a time longer, Gorel put on the harness, pulled on the ropes, and began the long, slow climb down the side of the cliff and back towards the ground. 16. The Dark Mage's army came into the city of Waterfalling at sunrise. They came quietly and with purpose, and they were not opposed. The city's residents looked at them with numb surprise, as though waking from a long and pleasant dream that was now, inexplicably, over. Gorel of Goliris was stopped only once, on his way out of the city, but the people who held him must have received orders from high up, or they let him go. And he rode away from there to continue his search for vanished Goliris. High above the city, at the place that was once called the Drop, the Lord of the Black Tor looked down on his conquest, but his attention was elsewhere. Far away, figures moved, numerous beyond count. They marched like shadows, but they were not shadows. They marched in rows. They marched upon the world. He saw them conquer cities, he saw them burn down temples, bring down gods, for gods and sorcery meant nothing to these soulless things. What they were, he didn't know. They moved like automata. They were a wizardry of a sort he'd never known, something ancient and deadly and newly awakened. They came from the desert. They brought with them the smell of burnt cardamoms. And as they moved, they spoke. It was a roar, a cry of triumph and despair. A single word.
Goliris.
Cecilia Holland. Cecilia Holland is one of the world's most highly acclaimed and respected historical novelists, ranked by many alongside other giants in that field, such as Mary Renault and Larry McMurtry. Over the span of her 30-year career, she's written more than 30 historical novels, including The Fire Drake, Rakossi, Two Ravens, Ghost on the Steppe, The Death of Attila, Hammer for Princes, The King's Road, Pillar of the Sky, The Lords of Vaumartin, Pacific Street, The Sea Beggars, The Earl, The Kings in Winter, The Belt of Gold, and more than a dozen others. She also wrote the well-known science fiction novel Floating Worlds, which was nominated for a Locus Award in 1975, and of late has been working on a series of fantasy novels including The Soul Thief, The Witch's Kitchen, The Serpent Dreamer, Verringer, The King's Witch, The High City, Kings of the North, and The Secret Eleanor. Her most recent novel is Dragon Heart. Here, a shipwrecked voyager finds himself in a situation dangerous enough that he might have been better off taking his chances with the raging sea, but a situation in which he must remain if he has any chance to satisfy the thirst for vengeance burning in his heart.
The Sword Tiraste, Cecilia Holland. From the first blow, the iron sang under the hammer. Thvalin sang along with it, pounding out the blade, long and straight and keen. He knew already this would be a noble sword, and it tore his heart to think who would own it. He thrust the iron back into the forge and said to his nephew, "Heat it up." Tulin worked the bellows. Tvalin wiped his hands on his apron. His shoulders ached. He went to the back of the cave and got a stoup of ale. Galdor at least kept them well fed. Tvalin was soaked with sweat from the work, which felt good, and he loved the smell of the iron heating and the sound of the bellows. He called the sword Tiraste, darling of the god of battles, but he never said the name aloud, to keep it strong. He said it in his mind often. He drank another long draught of the ale, and going back to the forge, he drew the white-hot blade from the coals. Lifting the hammer in his hand, he beat against the iron, and even through the tongs, the blade's high voice rang true. High overhead, a door creaked. Tulin said, "He comes," and backed away into the shadows. Tulin was afraid of Galdor. Tvalin laid the sword across the anvil, between him and the stairs, and down the steps came the king, massive in his bearskins, his feet scraping on the stone, and his eyes like a snake's. On his forefinger was a red jewel, and he carried a weight of gold around his neck. The two dwarfs bowed down. Tvalin was cursing himself for allowing them to fall into Galdor's hands. He said, "We are doing the work, King Galdor. We are keeping our end of the bargain." Straightening, he gestured toward the sword on the anvil. Galdor caught sight of it, and his face flushed red. His eyes gleamed. He said, "Ah, yes." He put out his hand toward it, but the ungripped sword was still hot, and he drew back. Tvalin let out his breath between his teeth. Galdor faced him, narrow-eyed again. "Finish it, and I will keep you no longer. Is that the bargain?" He looked from one dwarf to the other. Tvalin nodded. Galdor went back up the stair, heavy stepping. Tvalin went back to the sword, cooling on the anvil, and laid it into the coals again. His chest felt too tight. He knew Galdor was treacherous, and the king's last words rang with lies. He turned the sword again in the coals and drew it out and worked the foredge. With each stroke, he thought, "Tiraste, be evil. Tiraste, do evil. Tiraste, kill Galdor." They quenched the blade and honed it, fit on wooden grips and a pommel of a piece of ocean blood. Galdor would change those anyway to something gaudier. Tvalin lifted the sword in his hand, the balance perfect, the blade eager, and his maker's heart leapt at what he had done. Then the king came down again. Tvalin laid the sword across the anvil and stepped back. Tulin hovered next to him, wanting to be gone from here. Galdor threw back his cloak. He took the sword into his hand, and cocking it from side to side, he murmured under his breath, "A prince of blades," he said. "Tvalin, you are better even than your name." Tvalin swelled, pleased, and glanced at Tulin to make sure he had noted that. Galdor said, "Now let's test the edge." Too late, Tvalin saw what was happening. Galdor swung the sword around, and in a single stroke, sliced off Tvalin's head and that of his nephew. "See," Galdor said, up there above them. "Now I don't have to keep you. I'll board this room up so nobody bothers you." With the sword in his hand, he went back up the stairs. With his full strength, Varn hauled his oar again through the water. Night was falling. They should have made landfall long ago, and now they were deep into the narrows, here, between two coasts they didn't know, with a storm bearing down on them. Around him, his brothers and his friends were rowing as hard as he was, shouting the rhythm. A current fought them, the canard jerking and bucking. Back over the stern, he could see the rain blowing toward them, a shadow over the water. Above them, a craggy headland loomed. The first rain struck him in the face. The light was bleeding out of the sky. At the steerboard, his oldest brother suddenly called out and pointed. Barn cast a quick glance over his shoulder and saw a light bobbing in the dark below the headland, a signal, a buoy. His brother was already steering them that way. Barn flung his body against the oar. The wind helped them, heaved them forward. The rain pounded his cheeks and his wet hair got in his eyes. He bent to his oar and the blade struck something, and just behind his bench he felt the hull shudder. The light had lured them into the rocks. His brother yelled, "Hold on! Hold on!" Barn cast his oar overboard and jumped after it. He went feet first into the water, his hands out to fend off the rocks, and sank deep in over his head. When he came up, a wave hurled him over, and with him, the oar and a piece of a strake. In the murky darkness, he could make out nothing but the waves slap and churn. Then something huge loomed up before him, and his feet touched bottom, and he scrambled up onto the side of a rock. The storm wind battered him. He was shivering, and he clutched his shirt around him. Even through the wind and the sea, a scream reached his ears, and shouting. The torch on the shore cast a glow out onto the surging water. He leaned around the side of the rock and saw, against the uncertain light, bare hands raised against swords. He heard his oldest brother calling out, "No! No!" over and over. Then nothing. Men thrashed around in the shallows. A sharp voice rose, once, giving orders, directions. They were looking for pieces of the cargo. A keg bobbed in the slack water behind his rock. They would come to get that. He slid down into the rocking waves, in over his head, and waited there. Legs thrashed by him, close enough almost to touch, lifted the keg away, and moved on. He raised his head above the surface and listened. He could hear voices, in there on the beach, but now they were moving off. He dragged himself up out of the water onto the rock, found a crevice out of the rain, and pulled his shirt around him as well as he could, and waited to die. He did not die. The woolen shirt, which his mother had made, kept him warm, and this being midsummer, the sun was soon up again. The fierce waves of the night before had passed with the storm. He waded in through little ruffles to the beach. As he came in, the seagulls rose in a cloud from his brothers and his friends. The robbers had taken even their clothes away. He went from one to the other of the dead men, saying each name, noticing the wounds, and pulled them all together on the beach, as they had been on the canal together. He sat for a while beside his oldest brother, who should have gotten them into shore sooner, and should not have believed the light. His brother's body was hacked and battered. He had fought hardest of any of them. Barn piled up rocks over the bodies, making a boat shape, and putting in what bits and pieces of the canard had drifted into the shore. There was nothing left of the cargo, the furs, the salted fish, the casks of honey and wax. As he went around, he stamped on crabs and ate them, ate seaweed, dug up clams, and drank water that seeped out of the cliff. He did not, for a long while, look up at the top of the cliff. When he was done, he sat down on the sand and thought about his brothers and his friends and what had been done to them. Only he was left alive, which put a hard charge on him. Now he stood up and looked up at the top of the headland and the tower there, looming behind its wall. He rinsed the salt out of his shirt, slept a little in the sun while it dried, and in the afternoon, he walked around the back of the headland and made his way up. King Galdor, Lord of the Verboi, walked out to his high seat and laid the sword on the table before him. Standing there, he He looked out over the hall at his men, all on their feet, all their faces turned toward him, and he was still a moment to feel his power before he sat, and they could all sit. The slaves brought in the bread and the ale, and they fell to feasting. Galdor thought of his enemies. He wished, like Odin, he had no use for meat, and did not have to waste time in eating. A great dish came onto the table before him, a mess of fish, likely from the ship they had taken the night before. Peasant's food. He laid his hands instead on the sword in its sheath, with its pommel and grips of chased gold. The midsummer was on them, when Hjaldrik the Dane had sworn to challenge him, to run the strait against his will, and Galdor meant to turn that to advantage. The Vareboy grew too small for him. He wanted more than mere piracy. He pressed the sword under his hands. A man with his power should have a kingdom, and not a rock and a handful of men. He longed to take the sword into his hand, to loose the strength he felt in it, on some cause great enough for him. In the hall, a stirring caught his eye. Someone had come in from outside. He talked to someone, who talked to someone else, the little passage of the words going up the hall along the outside of the table. At his place just below Galdor, his man, Giffer, heard it, nodded, and stood.
"There is a stranger here who asked to see you."
"A stranger? A messenger?"
"No, just a wayfarer."
Galdor lifted his eyes. In the middle of the hall, a half-grown, gawky, beardless boy stood, broad-shouldered, with curly black hair, startling blue eyes, in a filthy shirt. Galdor said,
"Come up in front of me. Who are you?"
The boy walked up to stand below the high seat and spoke out.
"My name is Vagn Akerson. I have come over the sea, because I have heard such of your power, King, that I would join you."
Galdor leaned back in the high seat. He knew at once that this was both true and untrue. In this he sensed some witch work. The boy was both a danger and an opportunity. He laid his hands on the sword again.
"Vagn, what kind of name is that?"
"An outlander." Galdor thought again of Hjaldrik. He could always use another fighter if this one was apt.
"Well, perhaps you would prove your mettle."
He looked around the table.
"Thorulf Grimsson, stand."
At once they all began to move. Thorulf got to his feet, a bear of a man, all hair and muscle. The others pulled the tables back to make room in the middle of the hall. The boy Vagn stood there looking around him, and when Thorulf lumbered toward him, drawing his sword, the boy wheeled toward Galdor.
"I have no sword!"
Among the men now grouped along the wall, they gusted some laughter. Galdor said,
"What then do you offer me?"
He smiled, thinking, for all his big talk, the boy was trying to back out of this.
"But there are other ways. Bring out staffs. Let them fight that way."
He nodded to the black-haired boy.
"You still have your chance, see?"
He leaned on the arm of his high seat. He thought this could be amusing. Thorulf was a slacker and a stirpot. The boy was brawny and should have one good fight in him anyway. Galdor beckoned to the slave, who came quickly over to fill his cup again. Vagn stood in the middle of the room, now a much wider space, and gripped the staff in both hands, his knuckles up. He had fought often with sticks with his brothers. He knew the men who had killed his brothers were all around him. The lumpy, shaggy man tramping across the floor toward him held the staff crosswise. They batted at each other a few times, shuffling around, and Thorulf didn't change his grip. The men watching began to hoot and call out, spurring them on. Thorulf was already sweating. Vagn took a step to one side and struck, going high, over the upside-down grip, and Torruf blocked it, and with his counterstroke knocked Varn flat. The breath went out of him, but even dazed he knew to keep moving. He rolled. The following blow cracked on the rush-strewn floor beside him. He staggered to his feet. He had dropped his staff. He had made a mistake. He had to be keener. Tallroof was strong and knew how to do this. The big man plunged toward him, jabbing his stick at Varn's belly, at his face, and Varn dodged, ducked, jumped, flailing his arms out. The staff whipped past his ear and over his head. In the laughing, jeering crowd, someone whistled. Tallroof was red-faced, panting, and his little eyes popped. Big as he was already tired. He lunged around, swinging broad at Varn's head, and Varn dove past him into the middle of the room, rolled, and coming to his feet, grabbed his own staff up off the floor. The crowd roared. Tallroof plodded after him, out of breath, and Varn danced around him, luring him into another rush. When the big man charged, Varn stepped sideways and thrust his staff in between Tallroof's knees and felled him like an ox. A thundering yell went up from those watching. Tallroof sprawled across the rush-strewn floor, and Varn bounded after him and battered at him until he crouched down, his knees to his chest, and covered his head with his arms. Varn swung the staff up. He knew Tallroof had been there the night before on the beach. He wanted to drive the staff straight through him. The men howling and stamping around him were ready for a death. But then he heard Galdor say up there, "See if you can kill him." At that, he lowered the staff. His blood cooled. They were all around him. He couldn't kill them all now anyway. He put out his hand to Tallroof to help him up. The other men yelled, disappointed, derisive, and Tallroof swatted away his hand and got to his feet and went off. The other men were already moving the tables back into place, and the slaves were bringing in more food. Varn stood, watching all this. The others ignored him. He saw how they sorted themselves out, top to bottom, with Galdor up on the highest place. When everybody else had sat down again, he went to the lowest end of the table and sat on the end of the bench. The bread came to him, and he ate. The ale came to him, and he drank. Nobody paid him much attention. He thought about what he had to do here. All these men were guilty of his brother's blood, but it was Galdor who was the head. He looked up at the high seat, where the king sat fondling the sword. Wait, Varn thought to himself. He slept the short night on some straw in a corner of the hall. In the morning, he expected someone to come to him with work, as would have happened at home, but nobody was doing much of anything. Men came and went in the hall, rolling up their blankets, talking together, and sitting down at the tables to play chess and drinking. Galdor did not appear. A slave brought in some bread. Varn went off around the place, seeing what was there. As he had marked the day before, on his way here, the tower rose on the high point of the headland. A stout stone wall fenced off a wide half-circle of space around the foot of it, running from cliff edge to cliff edge. One high gate, braced and hinged with iron, pierced the wall, closed and barred. He went around the inside of the wall and found a little stable and some storerooms built along it. In the yard, some of the men were pitching axes. They paid no heed to him. Firewood stood in stacks along the foot of the tower, and tools lay around the yard. In the far corner, where the wall bent to meet the cliff, he came on the kitchen. In his experience, the three things he needed most, bread, clean clothes, and a warm look, all came from women, and women were usually found in kitchens. This one was a narrow room under a turf roof, with two ovens set in the stone wall and a row of split tree trunks for tables. People came and went through it steadily, and he found a corner at the top of a passageway, at the back of it all, where he lurked around until a wan, sullen girl noticed him. He wheedled her into giving him some bread. He was glad to see that girls were the same everywhere. Like cats, they loved to be stroked. He stroked her more, and she smiled, and then was pretty. He said so. She flustered and fluttered and went off to her work, kneading dough, her hands dusty white and her cheeks bright red. But a few minutes later, she brought him mead in a little flagon. As he took this, thinking he could kiss her, a rattling sound came up from the passageway behind him. The girl gave a violent start, her hands flying up. He looked around, into the dark throat of a corridor stacked high with wood for the ovens. "Where does that go?" She turned her wide eyes on him.
"Nowhere. Stay away from there."
She leaned closer.
"It's haunted,"
she whispered, and he kissed her. Later, he squeezed in past the oven wood into the corridor. As he went, he could hear the scurrying of rats, and he thought that was the noise he had heard. The corridor wound down steeply into the dark, but in a niche in the wall, under a dusty veil of cobwebs, he found a rush and a firebox. Someone had come down here often, but not recently. He blew the dust off the rush and lit it, and took it down into the dark. Around a corner, he came to a door, blocked with a bulk of wood. He moved the wood, and the door swung open. Holding the rush out before him, he went down a long flight of steps, and the cold air that came to him smelled of an ancient fire and of bricks and of iron. This was a dead forge, hidden under the tower. He reached the last step and turned, looking around him. Almost at his feet, something moaned. He went cold. He could not move, every hair staring. The sound came again. Down on the thick dust of the floor lay a shaggy head. Vaughn knelt beside it. The head's eyes were closed. Its long, thick hair was filthy with dirt and old blood, and its raddled beard trailed away beyond the reach of the rushlight. He knew it was a dwarf by its beard and its bristling eyebrows, its plug of a nose. Its lips moved, but only a moan came out. Vaughn remembered the flagon of mead, and took it from his belt and moistened the dwarf's lips. The lips moved, greedy, and smacked. They spoke again, but he could not make out what they said, and he fed them more mead.
"Tiraste," the dwarf whispered. "Tiraste, remember."
"What?" Vaughn put his head down closer. "What are you saying? Who are you?"
"Tiraste, remember,"
the dwarf said louder. The rushlight was going out. Vaughn looked around to make sure he knew where the stair was. He bent to the dwarf's head again.
"Tell me what you mean."
But all the dwarf said was,
"Tiraste, remember."
The light flickered out. Vaughn turned and went up the steps, groping along in the darkness. At the top of the stair, he shut the door and jammed the chunk of wood against it, and went on up to the light. Beyond the kitchen, a flight of steps went up the wall to a parapet overhanging the sea. Vaughn climbed up there, to the highest place, and stood looking out over the strait, where the wrinkled water spread out far into the distance. From here, Galdor had seen the Knarr coming, had seen from here that the little cargo ship was struggling, and gone down to lure it in. A foot scraped behind him, startling him, and he whirled around. Torulf Grimson was coming up the stair. Vaughn went stiff all over. Two steps from the top, Torulf stopped and looked up at him, squinting into the sun.
"You're going to need a sword. I'll help you get one,"
Vaughn said. "Very well. You go first." The big man turned and went down the steps ahead of him. At the bottom, Torulf waited for him to catch up and said, under his breath,
"That was Galdor yesterday. who did that?
He put his hand out and said his name. Vaughn shook his hand. They were walking by the kitchen, by the passageway there. He said,
Who is Tiraste?
Is that a name? Some girl?
In the high stone wall beyond the kitchen was a wooden double-sided door. Tulroof pulled the two panels wide open. The sun shone in on a narrow room, the wheels and shafts of a wagon, a pile of round shields, and a barrel of sand. Out of the barrel, there stuck up a forest of hilts and crosspieces. Tulroof gripped the barrel and rolled it forward. Vaughn saw again how strong he was.
Try this.
The big man pulled a sword out of the barrel and handed it to Vaughn. The hilt was neatly leather-wrapped, with a round pommel, but the blade felt heavy to him. He looked for something to try the sword against, and Tulroof pointed him out the door. In the yard just beyond was a stump of wood, notched and splintered, the ground around it caked with sawdust. Vaughn hacked at it. The battered chunk of tree was too low, and the angle was bad. Tulroof said,
Here, use this edge. See, that's the front edge. Try this one.
The next blade was spotted with rust and had a big notch out of the blade near the crossbar, but it felt better in his hand. He struck at the stump again, crouching to get the angle, and Tulroof said,
Good. Stiffen your wrist. Like that.
He thumped Vaughn hard on the back.
That's it.
Vaughn stepped away from the stump, his breath short. He was thinking of his brother. Two other men came over toward them.
What, Tulroof? Said one. Teaching him to beat you worse?
And smirked. Tulroof said,
That's Ketil. Ketil Tooth. And that is Johan, who is not even Norse.
Ketil grinned at Vaughn, displaying a jagged eye tooth pointing straight out from the gum. He said,
Don't get too cocky beating up on an old souse like him, boy.
The fair-headed